This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop at 95 Montrose Avenue in East Williamsburg. Learn more at brooklynballfactory.com.
Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tea and show us some love, all for the price of about two fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today. And thank you.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
The thing is, you know, I've literally done everything, you know, by myself.
You have?
Yeah. And that has been a lot, but I've been able to manage it.
Mm-hmm.
When I say team, it's, you know, usually friends that I've worked with at some point during my career, and they want to be a part of it, or they moved. I have a team in Amsterdam, mm-hmm. Paris, Copenhagen, and London, New York.
That is Rose Traore.
They come in. They take pride in being able to do it quickly, efficiently, clean.
Yeah.
You know, everything that you want, actually, from any cook, from
any kitchen.
Yeah. It's just that to them, their drive isn't, oh, the customers are so, so happy with my work. Their drive is, I'm feeding my family.
And that is Jose Arroyo, our guest today on a doubleheader episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses to make some sense of this. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I'm your host, Andrew Friedman, back after a short absence. I took a little vacation. I went down to Mexico with some friends of mine. I did some hiking. I played a lot of tennis, which was great. Truth be told, I was under the weather, as some of you may have heard on the intro to that show. And, well, that was a big bummer. You know, I'm glad to be back. I'm back at the home office. I'm getting a lot of work done. I am flying solo today. And as usual, that means the intro will be relatively short. I'm not going to monologue. I'm feeling a little rusty. So I'm going to get right to our guest this week. I think this week, you know, my intention when I recorded these two interviews, and it's been a while since I did both of them, I have a bit of a backlog that I'll be posting over the next few weeks. But, you know, as I was looking over who to pair with whom, I came across these two gentlemen, and I think they actually complement each other rather well because neither of them is a typical guest for this show. The first guest, Rose Traore, is, well, in some ways, he would seem to be a logical candidate for the show. He is part of the Kitchen Brigade at 11 Madison Park. But what Rose does is a lot of other stuff. First of all, he models, which if you see the picture of him on our Instagram page or on the show's website page, it will be clear that he's definitely qualified to do that. He's a handsome guy. He's also very tall. We did a little handshake hug after the interview, and I had to go up on my tiptoes not to, like, faceplant into his chest, but that's another story. But Rose does some modeling. He does pop-ups around the world, not just in New York, but around the world, mostly in Europe. He also does private chefing, and he really has a unique take on what he wants his career to look like, what he wants his time to look like. He talks a lot about the idea of freedom, wanting to be free, not wanting to be necessarily kind of, you know, tied to a kitchen 5, 6, 7 days a week, 15, 16 hours a day. He wants a little more flexibility and a little more oxygen in his professional cooking life. And that is what we talk about. I don't think I need to actually say much more than that by way of introduction. Some of you may know him on Instagram or from his website, or maybe you've seen his videos that he posts on social media, cooking demos and tours of restaurants he visits and things like that. But without any further ado, I'm going to kick it right over to an interview I quite enjoyed. It was our first meeting. Rose Traore, recorded several weeks ago at my friend Danny Abrams' restaurant, The Mermaid Inn, on the Upper West Side of New York City. Here you go. Can I make sure I'm pronouncing it right? Rose?
Rose, yes.
Traore.
Traore.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
On the dot.
What's the heritage of that name?
So my parents are from the Ivory Coast and Paris, and so, you know, I guess that's the whole background, if you
okay.
would say.
Does Rose, does that actually mean flower? I tried to look it up. It was a hard word to look up.
I mean,
I found a lot of different
answers. For me,
answers.
It's like mine is R-O-Z-E.
Yeah.
I guess just to make it a bit complicated and interesting. And
but does different. It have a meaning? Does it mean something?
I'll just think just like a rose.
It
to
is.
Be on, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Oh, but they meant it as sort of an adapted version of rose.
Yeah.
Oh,
in a sense,
okay. Because yeah. there are certain, if you Google that word with the markings
yep,
and accents,
yep, yep.
there are some definitions that come up that say flower, but then there's some that say not, you know, come up empty.
I think it's just
that was just them being
it's
cute.
Just, yeah, it's being cute.
Okay, we just met for the first time, like 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
I want to get your story going all the way back. You know, I've heard you state this differently. I've heard that you just say I've heard Seattle. And I've heard Portland
yeah.
as your place of origin. Where
yeah.
where are you from? Where are you from?
So I was born in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents wanted us to know, you know, where we came from. So we went. They had us living in Ivory Coast for 3 years, mm-hmm. Paris for 1 year, and then once my parents split, my dad moved us to Seattle. And so I did, you know, junior high, high school in Seattle, and
got
then,
it.
Went to college in Portland, La Quarta.
Oh, okay, got it. Okay.
And so, yeah, sometimes.
So that's why sometimes I
exactly.
see Pacific Northwest, because
exactly.
that covers everything.
Yeah.
Okay. How old were you when they got divorced?
I was like, I want to say 8.
Ooh, that's hard.
Yeah.
Was that hard?
I mean, to be fair, I really couldn't, like, remember too much about it, because one of the reasons why they sent us to Ivory Coast was while they were dealing with that whole
Got
situation.
It.
So it was
okay.
kind of like a quick blur.
Okay.
And then when as we got older, you know, then you realize, like, you know, they're not together.
Right. Interesting.
And
okay.
Mom goes back to Ivory Coast for a bit.
Yep.
Dad has a job in Seattle, and then everything just, like, you know, folds in.
Got it.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, all I continue to remember about my mom is just how much of a hustler she was, and just, like, totally grinding.
What did she do?
She owned, like, 2 hair salons in D.C. For, like, what? It's been 15 years.
Did she start as a stylist herself buy a place? Or
she started just in her basement, in our basement.
Really?
And when we moved to D.C. as,
okay.
you know, kids. And, yeah, you would just see her, you know, late night, while we're in the stairway, like,
yeah.
just, like, cranking it out. And she just built that name and environment to where it's, like, she was the top, like, hair salon to
mm-hmm.
go to in D.C., which
wow.
was cool. And then there was, like, a period where we didn't see each other for 10 years, which
right.
is, like, crazy.
At all?
At all.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because her papers got, you know, messed up, so she had to go back to the Ivory Coast.
Okay.
And she, you know, was there for a while, but then she's been back.
Okay.
So, that's
so
like,
now you guys are...
Now we've been, you know, reunited.
Okay, big smile when you say that.
Exactly. Yeah. My dad was a fisherman. He was a fisherman for a company called Arctic Storm in Alaska. Okay. That was pretty cool, being like, you know, young and going on, you know, this big boat.
He would bring you.
He would bring us before they, well, we would like drop him off before he leaves for 6 months or 3 months. Mm-hmm. And you just see all these like hefty, like men, women, just like all these massive equipments. Mm-hmm. Just like, it was pretty cool. And then while he was away, we were getting raised by like my stepmom, which was island, which was from Guam.
Mm-hmm.
And so, two things that I really remember, you know, during my childhood is my dad constantly cooking a lot,
mm-hmm.
and my mom also, you know, introducing us to her culture.
Mm-hmm.
So you have like, you know, the Ivory Coast, which is a lot of stews. It's a lot of fish.
Spices.
Spices.
Yeah. What kind of spices?
I mean,
like what pops in your memory when you think about that food?
For me, it's just the, it's pima. It's just like, you know, ground pepper, like just like so hot.
Yeah.
But you're just like fighting and just like constantly, it's like so good. And so I think that really enhanced my like love of food without me really noticing.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until like I had to figure out my shit for career, like for my career.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know. What am I going to do? Maybe I'll go to Le Cordon Bleu.
Before we get to that, can I just ask, you were born with a heart murmur?
Yep. I was born with a heart murmur, so I had to like go straight into surgery.
As an infant? As a newborn?
Newborn, fresh, which was mental. And so, yeah, they had to replace the valve.
And wait, when you say, but you mean like literally as a brand new baby?
Brand new.
It was that bad?
It was bad.
Because a lot of people live with hair, you know, they don't even know they have them.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was like horrible. It was bad, you know, from the jump. So I had to stay in the hospital for, you know, a good amount of time. Oof. There's still pictures where I'm just like, you know, this big.
Oh my God. With what? With stitches? And
with stitches, oof. With like cords, oh, and a little like bubble, if you would say.
Yeah.
So I did that. I mean, I had the surgery.
Yeah.
Survived. And when I was like 15, mm-hmm. I had to have another open heart surgery.
Yeah.
Because it wore, like, you know, there was like some leakage.
This is a valve issue?
Yeah.
Was your heart not pumping strongly?
It wasn't pumping. One side of my heart was working harder than the other side.
Got it. Was this what they call an ejection fraction issue?
It was like pulmonary, like valve replacement type of, yeah. And so had that. It was great. And about 2 years ago, I had to have another surgery, but it wasn't open heart due to technology. They just went up my groin for like, you know, 1 hour.
They did a catheter.
Yeah. 1 hour.
Yeah. And then they send like, you home.
Put the, you know, yeah. And I went home.
Yeah.
Like the next day.
On next day.
But I thought that was crazy.
Years ago, I had to, not years ago, 3 years ago, I had to have, it's an angiogram, which is the same thing. They go up, I had them go up my, no, because I write, I had them go up the way you did.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm very weird about my wrist and my hand. Like, I just don't want any, because they can do it through near the wrist. They give, at
can
least,
they?
There was a choice given, huh. And I'm like, no.
Yeah, I didn't.
I'm like, I play tennis, I write, I cook. Like, I really need this hand. So
can't have this go wrong.
But they said if we find anything, which fortunately they didn't, they said we might have to put in a stent.
Mm.
And, you know, we'll do that while we're, you know, with the cat. And I'm like, what? They're like, yeah, we run it down the thing. That's crazy. It still doesn't make sense to me that that's doable.
It doesn't, but I woke up.
Yeah.
And it seemed like everything is good. So,
how is all that? I want to talk about how this is sort of at least indirectly led to you cooking. But like, how do you think having this many? I mean, you seem very chill as you describe. Mm-hmm. You know, three, what for most people would be fairly major events, maybe frightening events. I don't sense a lot of trauma around you describing it.
Yeah.
Like how do you think it affected you? just in terms of your view, your outlook?
I mean, I'm very like headstrong with figuring out my way and really living like beat by beat. That's like how, that's, you know, the reason why I got this, you know.
Oh, I love it. You're showing me a tattoo. Yeah. Beat by, oh, is that a heart?
It's a heart.
Wow.
Like vibrating, beat by beat, dot, dot, you know.
Got it. So this is on your forearm.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty big tattoo. That's about, for what, sure. a 6-inch tattoo?
6-inch, yeah. It was like my second tattoo when I was in, you know, in college.
Okay. That's meaningful to you.
Yeah.
That's like, in terms of, what are you trying to like really squeeze everything out of each day?
Yeah. It's just like, you know, I think one of the biggest issues with life, and you would say maybe this, the industry, is everyone following the same paths or just like doing things because, you know, that's the way society has placed things. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been the type to go the opposite route and doing it because I want to do it. I feel good about doing it. Mm-hmm. I want to make a point from my, you know, perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my, you know, so when you're doing that, there's a, like, I think so much. So while you're having all these process, you know, going in your head, you gotta keep calm in a sense.
Did it give you, I mean, the way you're describing it, it sounds to me like it ironically, right, gave you a certain amount of freedom.
Yeah, and that's
of,
the biggest.
In terms of your just your thinking,
yeah,
right?
And like that's the biggest thing for me too. Is just like, I want to be free. That's like, you know, my, I want to continue to be free, whether that's breaking out from how society is trying to mold me, or just right. like, you know, a lot of us aren't free with what we want to do.
You mean within your industry?
Within our industry, yeah. life, you know, mm-hmm. and that's my biggest, you know.
Yeah,
goal.
I mean, if
every day.
If I'm honest, I just turned 52 this week.
Mm-hmm.
You are talking in a way, and it's probably related, right? Because for me, it's mortality.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have become much less analytical about what I do.
Yeah,
and it, weirdly, it's led to more success and happiness.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And but it's because I got to a certain point, and I'm like, I can't be bothered to worry about, you know. And also with relationships, like if I've started, just not in a dramatic way, I've just moved on quietly from toxic relationships.
Yeah.
Some of them with people who are probably useful to me professionally.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And I don't know if you people know who you are, but you've been a bad friend to me. But I mean, you know, I've just started letting go of all that. It's going to be fine.
Yeah, it's letting go, and it's also, you know, there's nothing wrong with not having a lot of friends.
Right.
You know, I know a lot of people.
Right.
But when it comes to friends,
yes,
I'm not ashamed to say that it's like 4 people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, that's just the way that, you know, first of all, I'm like on that path of just continuing to take my abilities to the next level, which takes a lot of self-awareness, self-thought, and a lot of processing.
Yeah.
And so with that being said, you don't got time for any other bull.
Right. I'm right there with you. Okay. Tell me how you start cooking.
So I started, you know, after school, I wanted to come back to D.C.
Yeah.
I wanted to, you know, check out my, like, childhood, in a sense, because I remember it being really fun. I wanted to go back in the house that we grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, like, all these memories that I wanted to, like, get back in. So I moved. I Google top chef, top restaurant in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
The Mandarin Hotel comes up with Chef Eric Zeebolt,
mm-hmm.
which is, like, the first introduction in the food world.
For people who don't know, Eric was an early, he was at the French Laundry in the early days, like back with John Fraser
exactly.
and all these kind of all, he's probably, He's probably in one of the pictures or two of the pictures in the French Laundry cookbook.
Yeah,
I would guess. Like, he was back there back in the day.
He was. Yeah. He was great.
Yeah. So you went to work for him?
Yes. So that was my internship, and so, you know, I arrive just dork, very green, huge knife kit.
What do you mean huge? Like the tackle box that give you like a cooking school?
Yeah.
Really? Exactly. Nothing that rolled up or?
Nothing. I mean, at that point, I wasn't even, yeah, nothing that rolled up. I don't even know if they.
I don't know how to square this with like this cool, you know, demeanor you have. You know, this whole persona you have now.
This was a different guy.
This doesn't fit.
This was a different guy. This was just a guy figuring shit out.
Yeah, this doesn't fit with the guy who came around the corner to meet me outside this morning.
No.
Okay.
So, you know, I go and I, you know, get placed on just prep.
Yeah.
Just, you know, small things. And it was like, you know, a tough time. One of the biggest memories that I had was chives, like cutting chives right. And that would be one thing that I like would mess up on and he would like blast me for.
Mm-hmm.
So I had, until this day, really, I have that stigma of just having, like, perfect chives. Like, you know, fluffy, nice, consistent. And, I remember right before service comes during their tasting, I get called up, like, what is this? Like, da-da-da, like, can't use it, put it out on the table. It's all, like, you know, in shambles. I would have to redo it, then go home, and then feel shit about that.
You said feel shit about that, but was there did part of you? I feel like people who thrive in, I don't know what you want to call that setting. I guess a fine dining setting.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing comes close to the way Keller's people. I think graduates of those kitchens look at like precision.
Yeah, I mean, precision, consistency.
And like, there's no room for deviation. I mean, and people who don't know those kitchens or don't know what, you know, aren't in the industry, maybe don't know what I'm talking about. I mean, no room for any deviation whatsoever. You think, how different could one batch of chives be from another?
It could be
different.
You could tell.
But did you like the striving for that? Did you like the discipline that was being asked of you, or did it seem?
I mean, the great thing about Chef Eric is that he would talk to you at the calmest level, but the calmest level felt like hell, like a dark cloud over you. Like you knew you were, you know, he didn't
mental need to, notes. Notes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, looking back at it and talking to you now, I really did not know what I was getting myself into.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know much about fine dining. I didn't know much about food to begin with.
Yeah.
I just landed on Google.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I wanted to, you know, work, do. I knew I wanted to be great, do work with the best, you know. And so that was the start. After I finished my internship, I worked at Bibiana.
I don't know that restaurant.
Which was like an Italian joint. Very cool. Mm-hmm. Very, you know, on the rise during that moment. And, you know, as I'm working in these places, I realized that New York is around the corner. Mm-hmm. It's a fashion capital, great restaurants. Why not check it out?
Mm-hmm.
So I spent some time at this restaurant. It's, you know, it's another thing where it's like I'm like 19, 20 at that point. Mm-hmm. I don't really understand it, but I'm going with the flow. Mm-hmm. I'm on like Garmo, but I never like really take it to the fullest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first time I got sent home, I thought that meant you don't come back.
Oh, okay.
And so these are like.
But what was your first gig in New York?
That was in D.C.
Yeah.
But my first gig in New York was the Mark
on the upper. Okay. Yeah. At John George's place. Okay.
So that was the first spot. And, you know, after working there, I also hear that you should get involved in modeling fashion. And I'm like, sure, I'll try that.
Had that not, was that a new, was that like a totally unpredicted thing that had never come up before?
I mean, I like had glimpse of it in Portland saying maybe you should do it, and it, it's Portland. What do they know about, you know, the fashion world? Nothing.
Right. Well, you're from there, so you can say that.
Yeah. And so I did like, you know, small cheesy gigs and I get here and it's, you know, you need an agency. First thing you need to do is build a book. And I went to like all the top agencies in New York, got doors slammed. My book was not right enough. And so
what was the feedback you got? Was there any specific?
The feedback that I got was too big, too tall.
You know what, like 6'4"?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was like the constant feedback. And also I didn't have that look that this was a different guy, you know, like 8 years ago.
So you've cultivated
exactly
the look, like, you have now.
The look, you know, it's, I just was not ready, which they were right. So then, you know, I'm still working in a restaurant, but I still want to break into this fashion world because I just love this. There's something about it that I love. I take the risk. I moved to South Africa for 6 months. I'm told you could build your book there. There's a great landscape. And it was like a trip with like five guys, five of my, you know, friends. Stayed there for 6 months, came back to the States, landed, got an agency. And that's when I started to go on these shoots and I realized that the food that I'm getting is like horrible. So I'm like, I appreciate you guys booking me, but I can also make this, like, you know, better. And they realized that, you know, my first passion is like, you know, being a chef. So I meet a friend that is also signed to the agency, Brendan Beck. And his company is Beck and Call. So he did all the front of front of the house, hustling up the clientele, and I did like the cooking. We capitalized all the top, you know, fashion brands from Victoria's Secret, Ralph Lauren, Ferragamo, Nordstrom, you name it. So I really enjoyed that, but I actually wanted to get personal with the client, actually like cook for Ralph, actually cook for, you know, certain celebrities, or take over like an event for these people. So now that I got an agency in New York, you know, prior to this, while I was in DC, I would, you know, still be working at the restaurant and having to get on a bus, come to New York, then the next day go straight to DC and, you know, get back to work, sometime even the same day.
Yeah.
So this is now where I'm like really involved in the fashion world and I want to take over. I've always been infatuated with London. So I would,
what's the interest? What does it hold for you? Like, what's the draw? If you can say,
I think it was just love at first sight. I mean, I think it was kind of love at first sight.
It's just something
I wanted to experience since I was a kid. Just like, you know, for silly now, but just like the accent, the style, and that I like, you know, save my money from, you know, the restaurant, and I would just like take a leap and just go without having any sort of guaranteeing as far as, am I going to get signed to an agency? Am I going to even get any work?
Right.
But I had housing, and that was like the biggest piece. So I go there. Probably it takes like 3 trips to London.
Yeah.
And coming back to the States, working, saving, and going back, and then I finally get signed. Now I'm really getting work in the fashion world. I'm getting, you know, highlighted as a chef and a model, and, you know, things are, the word's getting out. I start to meet actors, athletes, and then I'm like, let me know when you want to book me. I get booked by them.
Right.
Next thing you know, it's the Paris is next door. So I also like capitalize that as far as clientele.
Right.
And that is really where I've noticed that I like traveling is what where I'm the happiest, where I'm free.
Traveling.
Yeah, traveling. Yeah. And getting exposed to different cultures as like, you know, a single soul, just indulging myself in all of that. Mm. That is really where, you know, I was like, I want to cook for these, the best of the best. I want to try continue to get booked in maybe Venice and cook for, you know, some clients during the Biennale. And that's what I did.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, why would I not want to do this over a restaurant? This is what I like to do. So this is what I'm going to pursue.
What's the dynamic like? Well, first of all, can we just say I was trying to calculate it from other interviews and articles. Are you 27?
28.
28. Now. Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to be 28 in August.
Okay. Yeah. Which this will air right around your birthday.
Yeah.
What's your birth? Can I ask?
August 26th.
Okay. I'm going to try to stick the landing. Yeah. Maybe I'll get it on that week. I mean, this is all. I mean, this is you're a pretty motivated guy. I mean, yeah. This is all very young. Yeah. I mean, it'd be young to be able to work in a place like, you know. I mean, not crazy young, but to have history with a restaurant like 11 Madison, you know. But then to also do the modeling thing, which you didn't really start till you were what in your early
20s,
22, 23. Yeah,
yeah.
But what I was going to ask was, how do you think that piece of it affects your relationship? With clients, right? Because a lot of times it varies wildly, right? There's clients who treat private chefs, even like very well known famous people, kind of like the help, right? Anyone, people who do enough private chefing know what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
But then you come to it, you're not just a cook. I mean, I would never treat a cook that way anyway, but you're also a model, right? So does this question make sense? Do people tend to look at you almost like this weird combination of like someone who's cooking for them, but also like a peer in a way because you do have this public persona?
I mean, the whole...
Does that question make sense?
Yeah, the whole... one, the biggest goal for me is to change people's mindset as far as like... a private chef. Like when you say private chef, it kind of doesn't hold that high standard as like I own a restaurant, but I'm also telling you that I'm giving you that same quality and I'm able to take my restaurant anywhere with the best talented, you know, chefs across the world, period.
Yeah.
Due to the relationships that I've built. And, you know, of course it's all branding. It's my image, you know. Fortunately, that's what they're hiring me for, in a sense. It's like, you know, the talent, the image, and to really feel everything that we're about as a community of, you know, just hardworking chefs.
So let's explain this to people. I'll probably have said some version of this in the intro. You describe yourself as a private chef, but you, to me, you sort of epitomize where, and I've said some version of this on the show, where I think the industry is headed, which is you don't fit into one category. I mean, you use that term private chef, but you do pop-ups.
Yeah, it's more pop-ups, and it's also, you know, the end goal is to continue to have a voice in this industry and represent those that don't know how to express themselves beside just being in the kitchen to the world.
Yeah.
You know, like being a TV personnel is like ways that I really let that out. And that's like, you know, the next step is getting that TV show.
You want that.
That's the next work, because really expressing my love for food, fashion, and different cultures is really what I'm about. You know, what Tony did was something amazing for the world, and you know, like,
you're talking about Tony Bourdain, for the one person out there who doesn't know that. Yeah.
And so, you know, like, when I, like, it was his birthday recently, and then even when he passed, I was like, you know, I'm gonna make you proud, like, just because that is where I feel like my calling is, as far as being that next representative of the industry and really giving them that spunk that they've been lacking or not having.
What's the piece that most, that you most relate to? I mean, you're talking about someone who, you know, there's so many different facets mm-hmm. to what he did.
Yeah.
But which piece of it do you relate to most? Which piece of it, of what he did, which Anthony Bourdain yeah. sized hole in the universe do you feel like you
I think
fit in?
The fact that you know, going left instead of right.
Mm-hmm.
What, even when you're told you're supposed to go right.
Yeah.
Being free.
Yeah.
That I think, and obviously, and just being one single soul, involving himself in different cultures,
mm-hmm.
and
to that piece of it also, that,
yeah,
a sort of a conduit or a connection exactly. yeah. between a viewer mm-hmm. and other cultures,
exactly.
Yeah, you and would like to do that.
Yeah, and so that is also like you'll also see pieces of me, like you know, traveling and doing like maybe a pop-up, but mm-hmm. also highlighting other young amazing talent.
Yeah, that visiting people's kitchens yeah, and
that
restaurants. Yep.
That no one, you know, might know of in the States or yeah. you know, anywhere beside like you know their country.
Yes.
And so, you know, that's the next step for me, and also creating, you know, in the fashion world, you say like a fashion house, mm-hmm. Creating an environment where, you know, it's some where you're, the chefs are really highlighted and really recognized for everything they have, like, mm-hmm. and not downplaying their, you know, skills, mm-hmm. by just because, you know, like, Sometimes when you work with the best of the best, you know, you tend to forget the amount of talent that you're surrounded with,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes the person just needs to know like how talented they are. Like, you know, I think that kind of lacks as well.
Mm-hmm.
But
I'm not following what you meant by that. What do you?
As far as like
the person being
like a cook,
yeah,
like you know, really acknowledging.
Oh,
their,
I see.
Their, you know, their skills.
Got it.
Great. Also exposing them to a different world,
mm-hmm.
other than what they've been told to go straight into, which yes. is you know a kitchen. I think it is important for every cook to work in a kitchen at some point, but I'm just offering another outlet.
Yeah. Which, so you yeah. I've heard you say in at least one other interview that you might like to have a small restaurant someday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like a 30 seater.
Exactly.
But is your main vision for yourself to keep it mostly mobile? Engagements, pop-ups?
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely want to have something, you know, small
mm-hmm.
in the future, but at this point, it's just like having something where I'm constantly on the go.
Yeah.
With, you know, my team.
Yeah.
Under, you know, Rose LLC is mm-hmm. that. That's like, that's the thing.
So you just answered my next question a little bit, right? Yeah. Which yeah. is, what does it take to have this sort of nomadic existence that you want for yourself? Mm-hmm. You say your team. What is your team? Are there people that you kind of use as contract mm-hmm. support when you go on the road? Do you travel people with you? And do you have other, you know, do you have people who help you book? Do you have a manager who negotiates? Or is this all sort of you on and an iPhone?
The thing is, you know, I've literally done everything, you know, by myself.
You have?
Yeah. And that has been a lot. But I've been able to manage it.
Mm-hmm.
When I say team, it's, you know, usually friends that I've worked with at some point during my career, and they want to be a part of it, or they moved. I have a team in Amsterdam, mm-hmm. Paris, Copenhagen, and London, New York.
And is it the nature of what you do that these are people you don't even have to catch them between jobs? You can they can just schedule themselves a day or two where they can come do it for you and they get a piece of the action.
Exactly.
And that's, and you have a little network like that.
Yeah.
You like it like that.
I like it like that.
It's kind of like a heist movie.
I like it like that. It's free. It's, you know, just like come check this world out, you know. And then, you know, some chefs, they just don't care about any of that. They just want to be in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And there's that tingle when you're in the kitchen and you're able to like indulge all of this pressure and just overcome it and rise. But you also get that something like that in the private world.
So private chefing is one thing, you know, you have like your repertoire, but then also there's the desires, maybe even dietary restrictions or even just stuff people don't like to be negotiated, right? When you do like a pop-up or an event dinner, you know, you're a really young guy, right? Can you define what you would say your style is right now? Like left to your own devices, do you have a style that you can define? Do you have dishes that you would consider signature dishes or sort of things that are like, you know, like Keller has the salmon cornet, right? That's always going to be there. Are there versions of that in your own repertoire? Like no matter what you do, if it's a pop-up, like you're going to see this.
You're going to see this. I mean, right now, to be fair, it's like everything is just based on, you know, environment, people. So it's like still getting figured out, you know, but as far as like style, it's very clean. It's I'm very into like, you know, like sea, connecting with the sea. And so like a lot of, you know, seafood, fresh.
Does that go back to your dad or does that just go back to growing up in the Pacific Northwest?
I think it just goes back to just being from the Ivory Coast and just like constantly enjoying fresh, the freshest of the fresh, or like traveling to Venice and really getting a hint of like, you know, some good octopus, you know, things, you know. So if you would say it's like I still have the French in me due to school and, you know, relatives, so it's like very modern but in a sense fresh and classic. If that makes sense.
It makes sense. You were smiling big as you say that.
Yeah.
Why does that amuse you?
Just because it's also like, I'm sure not a lot of people have heard that type of description.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've said this before on the show. I think most chefs, if you ask, like the question I just asked you is, that's like a question you get asked when you hire a PR firm.
Mm-hmm.
Like most chefs, like I'm sure I'm going to guess, tell me if I'm wrong. You'd probably like to just go like, my style is what I do.
Yeah.
You know, it's Rose very, cuisine. It's like it's my food.
Yeah, like, I feel like
you start putting adjectives to it, you start putting a box around it.
I mean, having a signature dish is something that is definitely something that I've been thinking about.
Yeah.
I think it's cool.
And you use the word brand in this conversation. Yeah. Like, that helps a brand, right? To have something that's like, you got to have, did he do X? Like, did he make that?
Exactly.
Did you have that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, right now it's just, I'm at the point where I'm getting involved with, like, you know, PR agents and really taking it to a whole new notch, you know, because if I've been able to do all this on my own, you know, they should be able to rev the wheels a bit more.
Yeah, so, right. You've set it up. Exactly. You teed it up for them.
Yeah. So
what you seem, I am really struck talking, you know, especially given the answer you just gave me that you do a lot, you know, almost all this yourself or all this yourself. You seem so calm.
I mean, I get that.
You seem like you have all the time in the world sitting here, which you clearly you cannot possibly.
I get
Go ahead. Sorry.
It's also, you know, like when I'm in the kitchen or when I'm in that like environment, it's beast mode. You know, it's a different.
Right.
You have no choice but to like be very like.
Intense.
Yeah. And so when I'm out of that environment, I like to just be me, like be, you know, the Rose that, you know, not everyone is like, you know, expecting to see.
Sure. But do you have to do anything to achieve that, if you don't mind my asking? Like, do you meditate?
Do you exercise? Like, this morning, I love saunas. I love saunas and steam room. This morning, I had a good, like, you know, 20-minute steam session. Okay. Had a good workout.
Okay.
Usually, I start my day off like that. It's,
okay. I don't want to be like your Jewish calm. Mother, but is that okay for your ticker?
It is.
With the issues you've had?
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Just don't.
Some of those things aren't like hot tubs, I think, are bad for. Something it depends like on the that. Condition.
I mean, also, how long are you spending in there?
Right. No, I know. Not. I mean, I'm just asking.
Yeah.
So, no, but what I was going to say is a lot of people have a hard time flipping that switch you're talking about, especially because a lot of times people who are working kitchen jobs don't get 2 days off in a row.
Yeah.
You know, the analogy I heard once was like, it's like why the same reason you see people still jogging around a parking lot after a marathon.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to just stop.
Exactly. Right? Like, great thing, though.
But the sauna thing is interesting.
I love it. It's.
What do you. I read that you loved it because you're obsessed with skin quality.
Skin quality helps. Yeah. Exactly.
But beyond that, what do you love about it? You feel. It's you also, like the water.
Yeah. It's also just like, it's very. Calming, like,
yeah,
you know, I do love the water. I love the sea. I think that's.
But
like
that connects to that same thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like one of the most beautiful elements, but also could be dangerous.
Okay.
And so, but speaking on 2 days, you know, something great about 11 Madison Park is you do get 2 days off in a row, like, you know, most of the time, unless it's main menu change, and that's a little, you know,
all
different.
Hands on deck. Yeah. Yeah.
But I think when you talk about qualities and just restaurant cultures, I would never work for, I wouldn't work in another establishment other than, you know, these, other than, you know, 11 Madison Park, because it's like, it's not the same three Michelin, yeah, but as far as like actual care, you know, for, you know, the, it's a good family. It's a good family. Everyone is, we all know that we're in, you know, the dumps, we're in the shits every day. Everyone's running around, but what really keeps you going is the fact that I'm not going to work by myself. I'm going, like, I guess, like, we hold each other up, and there's not, you know, constant just getting bashed in the kitchen. Like, it's hard enough being in that environment, and so they understand to not make it worse.
Yeah, right.
And you could get, there's the most talented, you know, chefs in that place. You know, speaking about working with Eric Zeebolt, he was, you know, an amazing guy. And then I also meet this guy named Brian Lockwood.
Oh, yeah.
Which is incredible.
Yeah. Same vibe. Tell people who that is. Tell people who that
Brian is. Brian Lockwood is a CDC at 11 Madison Park, chef de cuisine. And same culture. He worked at the French Laundry. I've known him for about 2 years now because I did some time at the Nomad, and it just clicked with just how talented he is, but also not loud and like just like all this ego. It's more about he just wants to continue to teach. And for me, that's what really strikes is like the egos. There's a lot of egos in the kitchen, and you do not get any like respect from me in that sense.
Yes.
But if you're able to teach,
yeah,
and you're constantly willing to teach despite your caliber, I think that's one of the things that I really admire.
You consider that part of the job?
That's part of the job.
Yeah.
Like, you have, like, we're all here to learn from each other. We learn from each other. We teach each other in the kitchen, you know, like, and so I think that's like another, you know, great guy to mention, especially when you talk about the dark cloud over and like him being so calm.
What do you mean the dark just cloud,
like,
over?
Just like Eric, just like Eric Zeebolt, like, even when you, like, you know, mess up, it's still like, you know, it comes off strong without him, like, you know, throwing things around or like.
That's because you respect him.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And we all, like, have that respect for each other.
Yeah, that to me is like the that's like people who have made it to found that place mm-hmm. where they don't want to be a screamer.
Yeah.
You know, command enough respect that exactly. just a look or a yeah. you know, it's come up a bunch on it. Patrick O'Connell, who I recently interviewed, is like that. Tony Montalbano from yeah. Chicago. It seems to be this place that people aspire now to get to.
And they also
and it's fine. It I mean, clicks. You're not. It's not high. You know, there's a line I love from a movie where this director says, "It's not the high school play. Like yeah. you got to get the job done."
Exactly. You it's, know, it's like, also it wears off on you too because it's like. You're able to give that look or like you're able to have that energy that's yeah. like so wavy to where it's like when you like approach someone that's in your way that shouldn't be in your way
yeah.
they just piss off.
So why can I ask why do, I mean one answer might just be money and that's fine, but it seems you got a, like a, between the modeling and the yeah. and the other stuff probably enough going on to pay the rent.
Yeah.
Why are you working? I mean, I know it's 11 Madison. It's one of the best restaurants on planet Earth.
You said why?
Yeah, but why are you in a kitchen?
All right, so that's a great question because you know
me,
I got
can I preface can I ask honestly if tell me if you don't want to answer. Mm-hmm. Do you need to be in a kitchen?
No.
That you're there by choice. You don't have
by
a
choice.
You don't have a financial need
no,
to be there. Right.
I'm there okay. by choice.
So then why are you there?
So it's great you asked that because I got in this phase where it was like the fashion was kind of like overshadowing the chef,
mm-hmm.
the chef world. And when I started, I was like the only like chef and model that was actually doing it in the States.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had like one more in London. 4 years later, 3 years later, you have like all of these like random chefs that are modeling and all they're doing is like avocado toast. And I wanted to like really separate myself from that and be noticed just as a chef.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't want to have that title as far as like model. And, you know, it was just like it got a little annoying to me. So I was like, I'm going to do what I know these chefs can't do, which mm-hmm. is work in a restaurant. And so that led me to the Nomad.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first big introduction to like, you know, Michelin, mm-hmm. if you would say. So I go there, crank that out for a year in between, you know, some traveling in Europe
mm-hmm.
and still doing a private gig, really nail that out, really crush it.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, it was also for me to know that I can, you know, do it. I've always had this, like, not a lot of people know, but I've always, like, went to, like, restaurants. But I was, like, I was inspired by seeing people on the line, but also, like, in a way, kind of, like, intimidated to where it's, like, can I, like, do this at this, you know, right now?
So you want to see if you have the goods.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So then I, like, went. I, you know, did the whole spiel, lined, you know, hotline, mm-hmm. all of this. And really, like, because it's like, if I'm going to tell people that I'm at this high standard, this, you know, and this is what I represent,
mm-hmm.
I need to, you know, talk the talk and walk the walk.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and from the outside, if I'm understanding you right, you know, we're at an era where maybe this sort of category of chef you're describing mm-hmm. for yourself isn't quite recognized
yeah.
or even named, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, for lack of a better word, to the outside,
exactly.
people who haven't been to one of your dinners, it legitimizes you.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Oh, he's at 11 Madison
yeah.
Park.
Yeah, and then it also...
So it gives you that instant...
It gives you that yeah. instant, it's...
Credibility.
Yeah. It makes people, you know, trust you a bit more
mm-hmm.
and you're not full of shit.
Right.
You know, the James Beard dinner that I did was like something that was incredible.
Yeah.
And they don't even do private chefs.
Mm-hmm.
They usually do restaurants
mm-hmm.
or like bigger companies.
Yeah.
And so they were even like, we never do this, but we'll take the risk.
Did you pitch them on it?
I did.
You went to them?
Yeah. And, I've never thought about cooking for the James Beard. I just woke up one day and I'm like, I want to get this under my belt.
Nice. How was the experience?
It was great.
Yeah.
To, you know, knock them out of their, you know, socks, even for like, you know, the head part, like, you know, two of the head yeah. people at the yeah. eight that manages the house is mm-hmm. like saying this was like one of the best in 10 years.
Yeah.
That feels great yeah. at this age, and, you know, literally uniting all of my friends
yeah.
in the industry to like come together and, you know, make it happen. Yeah. Chefs from Danielle, chefs from Nomad, 11 Madison Park, we're just like united, crushed yeah. it. And it was kind of like the first time where people actually saw what I was about, because yeah. mainly all my stuff were like, you know, on a private side, or yeah. you could have it in a pop-up, but usually those pop-ups are in Europe. And yes. so that really like enhanced the, like, you know, the company's value, my values.
Yes.
And we're still getting some more tick marks.
Can you just speak to, it's funny what you said about 11 Madison Park, right? And then having the audacity to like go after the Beard House, right? Mm-hmm. Well, audacity in your case is probably the wrong word.
I did
it was,
that.
It was appropriate.
I
right?
did that before EMP.
Oh, before, I like did, well, you had been at Nomad.
I did Nomad.
Okay.
Left for, you know, a
yeah.
I did that for a year. Then, you know, 6 months later, yeah. I did right after, you know, my Europe trip.
Yeah.
In January, I booked the James Beard
Got
dinner.
It.
And then after that, 2 months later, I started at EMP.
So I'd love for you to just speak for a minute. A lot of cooks listen to this show, right? There's two sides to what you're describing. One is going for it.
Yeah.
Right? Don't be shy.
Yeah. Go for it.
Go for it. Seek it out. Ask for it.
Yeah.
Pitch it. Whatever yeah. it is, right? The flip side of that, and it seems like you really have a good barometer of your own mm-hmm. Place right yeah. now, right? Like where you are in your own trajectory.
Yeah.
The danger in that advice to go for it is you don't want people who are delusional, right?
Exactly.
Like somebody
yeah.
who's really not, you don't want someone who just got yeah, out of cooking yeah. school
no,
calling the James Beard House just because yeah, they're like no. nervy enough to do
yeah,
it, right?
Yeah,
so how does this make sense? It's kind of an abstract thought. Like how do you periodically take stock of where you are?
And how
And know
far
what's appropriate, yeah,
yeah,
how far you can push.
Yeah.
Like maybe... Like, you know, I had an old friend of mine used to say, you're never qualified for your next job.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's always going to be a slight leap of faith. Because, mm-hmm. like, you had never done the Beard House
yeah,
before.
Never.
But you felt like you were ready. You felt like you'd have
yeah,
enough
yeah.
stuff under your belt.
I mean, I feel like...
Is it just
the
you feel like you just have a good sense
me,
of it?
For me, it's just like, you need to go for it.
Mm-hmm.
You need to go for it. And there's always a leap.
Yeah.
But... sometimes I don't even get responses, but I could guarantee you that those people now know who I am, you know? And so there's
that's
like,
that's a different smile. I just got from all the
like,
other ones.
You know,
that's
it's,
like, yeah.
it's more like, you yeah. know, I don't even yeah. get upset at that. It's because
right.
it's like,
you're playing
saw,
the long
now,
game.
Yeah. It's yeah. like, now you saw my name. We'll have this conversation.
You don't close
on.
The door.
No.
You don't hold grudges at people?
No.
No. That's good.
I'm just like, I'll see you, you know,
right.
at another time.
Yes.
And I think the biggest thing is just believing, it sounds so redundant, but the whole, like, believe in yourself and not have people manipulate you to
their end.
But to their end
yeah. Yeah.
is the biggest thing, you know,
yeah.
and I think... As cooks, you know, like, kind of forget how talented they are, and
yeah.
I'm just there to just show them that we got this.
Yeah,
you know.
So, you know, I've alluded to this a few times as we're talking here. I feel like you do represent the edge of the next generation, right?
Because mm-hmm.
I do feel like. It sounds like for you, it's more of a philosophical lifestyle thing
yeah.
that you don't want to be beholden to like a brick and mortar situation.
Yeah.
But I think some people who maybe did want that, right, aren't going to be able to have it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you
to
look
be
at
realistic.
You look at New York. Well, just look at the big cities right now. Places are. I mean, this city right now is like places are closing left
yeah.
and right. It's going to keep happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and everyone says, you know, and then everyone's like, oh, people are going back home to, you know, well, your hometown or one of your hometown, yeah. But Portland is booming. I was at Feast last year. I hadn't been to Portland in 20 years.
I haven't been in Portland in a while. Oh, I need to go back.
There's so much.
I miss it.
But at all levels, and it feels like, at least from the outside, like there's a lot of mutual support.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but all those places are going to get maxed out,
yeah,
right?
For sure.
And I think it's already happening. You're going to see, you know, residency. When did we start using that word? 3 years ago?
Residence,
but that's
yeah.
the big thing. You know, like the Chef's Club here in New York, mm-hmm. like J.J. Johnson yeah, was there, yeah. Paul Liebrandt, and then Racine's has kind of had some people. And
J.J.'s had a good year. Shout out.
Yeah. But you know, like, but that was that for him. There was a period where he did that. It sustained mm-hmm. him. It, yeah. I think was. Good.
I think it's very. I don't want to just say don't work in a restaurant. You need to do that because you need to understand the culture and ground yourself before you have your own beliefs. You know?
I get that, but no. What I was going to ask was, I do feel like we're going to be seeing more people who kind of are going on a track similar to mm-hmm. yours, maybe not exactly. And I just think it's going to be a practicality in the yeah. future. You know, I've mentioned Paul Liebrandt hasn't been in a restaurant for probably 5 years now.
Yeah.
You know, but he does pop-ups. He did this, you know, the things moving, I just named. Yeah. And I think that's becoming more and more a legitimate way for somebody to be a chef, right? Yeah, I just recognize. Don't think the vocabulary is caught up to it.
Yeah.
Right? So I was just going to ask you whether at EMP or just in your circle of acquaintances, do you see more of this? Are there more people like in your orbit that you know that are cooks or yeah. chefs who want something in the same ballpark as you? Is this something? Do you see this coming the way I believe it's coming?
They want to, but they don't know how,
mm-hmm.
and they're very like intrigued on when I could get them involved that next gig. It's in a way to them. It's like. It's inspiring because, like, you know, I don't go in, once again, I go in the kitchen not mentioning a blip, you know.
When you go to work.
When I go to work.
You don't talk about it there.
I don't talk about, like, who I am on the outside.
Yes.
I just, you know, because it's a humbling experience.
Sure.
Like, there's no need to bring any sort of egos.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, that's how you get bullied. Second of all,
I was trying to find a moment to yeah. ask you, like, if you know, get like a lot of crap from people.
Second of all, I'm just also here to build my strengths, you know, but I also still have my mindset, which everyone is aware. But then you also slowly have people like discover who you are
mm-hmm.
on the outside world, yeah. and then they really are like inspired with, you know. How there's a lot of hows,
mm-hmm.
and yeah. you know,
so people want to pick your brain, they want to yeah, learn by osmosis, exactly. they want to,
yeah, like
come do stuff with you so exactly. they can kind of make mental mm-hmm. notes and kind of, yeah,
and then you know, like the numbers are actually getting higher because you have like probably like 7 cooks in one day at times, just email or Facebooking, like, hey, let me know when. Your next event is, would love to, you know, work with you. Mm. It's, you know, it's inspiring, like you're, you know, moving and, you know, that is what the community is about, mm-hmm. you know, because you're showing off a different world.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, landscape of heaven in a sense, but nah.
Nice.
yeah. So just sharing that love for, through food,
yeah,
and involving ourselves through different cultures and really understanding our self-worth.
How specific is your plan? Do you have a plan? I'm not asking you to share, but do you have yeah. like a 5-year plan? Do you have a 6-month, you know, is it broken into 6-month
like,
periods?
I have like small plans as far as like, you know, small steps, but mainly it's like a lot of free falling.
You're a dreamer.
A lot of free falling and going with the wind, but also being aggressive with mm-hmm. the doors that I'm knocking on.
Mm-hmm. Do you consider yourself a dreamer? I mean, that is a compliment.
I think I'm definitely a dreamer that continues to dream, and there's just that urge that there's the vision that I see.
Yeah,
and I understand in my head that. I know might not come across to others as fully, but it's okay because
you know where you're going.
Exactly.
Yeah. Even if you don't know exactly how it's going to happen.
Yeah. I know what I'm knocking on, mm-hmm. you know.
Can I ask what other, I mean, you do more than one thing, right? You mm-hmm. do the modeling thing and cooking. Yeah, you like a sauna.
Yeah.
What about other, what kind of like art, music, literature? Like what? How do you spend your time taking in, when you have time to take in other people's creativity, what do you give your attention to?
I could spend 3 hours on just listening to just good music.
Yeah.
Like soulful, good, like.
Any particular genre?
I've been stuck on Frédéric Chopin,
mm-hmm.
some Miles, some Coltrane. You have, this is like, I love like Buena Vista
Social Club.
Exactly. Like
my late stepmother was from Cuba, so yeah. I have a fondness for that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That you have some, I love the Stones.
Mm-hmm.
The Stones are, you know.
Are you going to see them this summer?
Maybe. Not sure.
Okay.
I'm a huge, you know, Jagger fan.
Yeah. Do you, when you said you could just sit for 3 hours, you mean you don't put it on as like background music, like while you're cleaning your apartment or something? You mean you can just sit and give that your full attention?
I just put it in the apartment and just like vibe to it. Just mm-hmm. like
find a comfortable spot and just.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, when I get out of the kitchen sometimes at 2 a.m., I get home, put that on. Have, you know, a glass of whiskey, maybe some wine, and I write every night.
Oh, you do?
Because that's also a project that I'm planning on, like, putting out there is, you know, that life as a young chef in a 3 Michelin restaurant.
So this is a journal?
This is, like, a journal that I'm going to take pieces out of and put out mm-hmm. and involve in the book. Because I don't want to just put out like a regular recipe book. Essentially, I want to put out something that, you know, maybe a little recipes, but also really highlights who this guy is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's something that is so obvious, but like being the only, how does it feel to like be the only black guy in the kitchen
mm-hmm.
or the only other black, the only black chef in the kitchen, mm-hmm. but also not feeling any sort of way because at the end of the day, it's like, it's like get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, you know, I feel like at times, or, you know, you really get a hint of like my psyche and like real, you know, these are going to be like, these are my best pieces. You know, your mm-hmm. best pieces are, it's like in this stage.
Yeah.
And so,
since you mentioned it, how does it feel to be? I mean, are you currently the only?
Yeah.
You are?
Yeah.
Has that been the case in most of the kitchens you've worked in?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those where I don't think about it too much. I mean, that's how the world is,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a sense.
Yeah.
I don't really think about it because it's just that community of where it's like, get it. It's just a group of warriors.
Mm-hmm.
Like, get it done. We're a family. And so that's really how I, like, you know, feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, I think it's a interesting set, like, topic that I've been trying to figure out why.
Why there aren't more black people in fine dining kitchens?
Yeah, like,
did you listen to my interview? I know we talked before the show. You've listened to that. Did you hear the interview with Kwame?
I didn't hear that one. I didn't hear that one because he also did some time at EMP.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't listen to that one.
But, you know, I'm not going to ask you to comment on this controversy, you know, because he's made some pretty strong statements about his experience. But I don't want to get you
in
like the middle
of that. It was like a different time. He was there like a while ago.
Yeah.
And I like the way that the kitchen is at now, I feel like it's a lot different.
But what I was going to ask is, you know, his comment was that he thought that just by the visuals, right? Mm-hmm. Like if there's only one black guy in the kitchen, then someone, a younger cook, looking at those kitchens may just not feel like there's a place for them there, mm-hmm. you know, or that they don't want to be. He didn't say it this way, yeah. but I know I wouldn't want, you know, I can't, if I'm extrapolating, trying to imagine myself, I'm like, well, I don't want to be like, the one guy. Yeah. And that seems like a self-perpetuating thing. Does that kind of make sense from where you sit?
I think it, even if I'm not saying it, in a way, it kind of, it affects you in some way, you know, but you just, I mean, the way that I deal with it, it's like, all right, great. I'm going to just crush this whole thing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to just dominate this as much as I can and just like keep going and just like get like, you know.
Yeah.
If you're going to be highlighted, you might as well be highlighted to the fullest.
You know what is funny though, because like Milton Abel was on the show, right? Mm-hmm. And do you guys know each other?
Mm-mm.
Okay, but you know who I'm talking. Yeah. So he worked in both the two flagship Thomas Keller restaurants, right? And we were interviewing, and I said to him, I said, you know, you kind of fit the profile of like a Keller chef.
Yeah.
It didn't occur to me till after the interview. Like in some ways, that's not true. There's not a lot of black people in those kitchens. Mm-hmm. But in some ways, it very much is true in that, you know, Milton's like, he's Midwestern. He's very clean cut. He's yes sir, no sir. You know, like his dad, I think, had been in the military, you know, which Thomas's dad had, right? Mm-hmm. And like, and a lot of levels, he actually is sort of the prototypical, like I always say, Thomas Keller hires like G-men, you know, people who could be in the FBI, people who don't call attention to themselves. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
In some ways, I feel you kind of fit that profile. Sure. Like there is this very conspicuous thing, which is you're not a white guy.
Yeah.
But in a lot of other, like you're very clean cut. Mm-hmm. You're very put together. You're very serious. Yeah. You're very, right.
Yeah. I mean,
Does that make it more go down easier for you? Does that make you feel less?
I mean, I feel you. It's the culture.
Yeah. Right.
It's where you're at 12 hours a day sometime, you're getting brined in this culture. And it's like, I think being able to accept it and not taking it personal is also another, you know, element.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being in it when you, I couldn't do this when I was 20. I could not work at 11 Madison when I was 20. I see some working there now, and I'm like, you're brave. You like, just because at that time, I would have taken everything personal. And like,
for that reason, because of the race differential.
Maybe that, and also just like with maybe getting spoken to a certain way, and like, you know, I just have a different mindset where I could handle that, you know.
Right. We understand it's not about you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know. And so that's where I'm at now.
Yeah. Can I ask you a really frank question?
Yeah. Because
I feel like we're communicating well.
For sure.
You know.
You're good at your questions.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah.
But I know.
And you're able to actually listen and
thank you.
Flip it.
Thank you. But, you know, race is like, there's a lot of talk about race in this industry. There's a lot of talk about everything. Race, sexual preference, everything. So it's come up on the show a bit. I mean, I'm like a middle-aged white guy, right? So we just spent about 10 minutes talking about this. Mm-hmm. Be totally honest with me.
Yeah.
Did I ask you any stupid questions? Did I miss anything? Is there a nuance I'm missing?
No, I mean,
is that question? You know,
being,
what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's just being,
because it's very
straight up.
I feel like it's a very fraught time right now to talk about these things. But I feel like it's important to talk about these things.
I feel like it is important to talk about it because it's like everyone needs to understand each other's perspective and understand why.
Yeah,
they're thinking that way, or like, you know, half of the time. Like, you know, both cultures, it's two different cultures. Of course, like, you know, you're not going to understand it fully, but as long as there's, like, step forward on trying to figure what the other person has been through or,
right,
you know, I think that's the biggest part.
Right. I just want to do a reality check. Yeah. You know, you have these conversations, and you know, I'm on the quote unquote privileged side of the equation, right?
No, yeah.
I mean, we were both born into this
into
this dynamic. But I always wonder, you know, like, I hope none of those questions seem like moronic. I hope I didn't, want to be like that guy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Anyway, all right. Well, thank you for that. I hope you're being straight with me because I really would want to know.
100%.
All right. Well, thank you. All right. So let me ask you one last question. I don't want to be, you know, you've had heart valve issues. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had friends who are older than you who've had those issues. There's not yet a permanent fix for these things. Mm-hmm. Like, they tend to eventually...
Every 15 years.
Is it every 15? I didn't know what that specifically... Mm-hmm. So that's part of your landscape as well.
Yeah.
How's that affect you?
I mean, to be honest, it's never really... I've never had it weigh me down.
Mm-hmm.
I do what I want to do.
Cost of doing business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, obviously working in an environment like that, like, you know, 11 Madison, I've had, I've had, like, a good amount of stressful times.
Mm-hmm.
But you also understand, it's kind of like, with all the background, it's all, like, instruments playing to your ear, and it kind of, mm-hmm. like, calms you down in a weird way to mm-hmm. where you don't, like, you know how to, like, take it easy. Like, mm-hmm. it's all right. It's gonna... When you realize that you have a team of like 50 cooks,
mm-hmm.
like no one's gonna let you down. That's the good thing.
Yeah,
you know, like relax, figure it out.
Yeah,
think. But yeah, I've had a couple anxieties for sure. But yeah, I mean, like where you feel like your chest is about to like just, you know.
Yeah,
you're like. Or your guts are just like, you know.
Yeah.
But it's a part of the game.
It passes.
Exactly. It passes after like 20 minutes. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm glad we met.
Definitely. I'm glad we did it. I'm glad we had some very good convos. I always try to like expose a bit of myself through all of these.
You're very open.
To where... I'm not repeating myself on with the same, you know, thing and just being real and being frank about who I am. And so that's something I've been working on because it's good for the people to know.
Cool. Well, I hope this helped the cause.
It did.
Okay. Sure, and I'm looking forward to watching your career.
Definitely. Thanks for having me.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop at 95 Montrose Avenue in East Williamsburg. Brooklyn Ball Factory uses the best ingredients to make Japanese comfort food, like their bento boxes featuring meatballs, grilled veggies, Japanese fried chicken, or pork shabu shabu. Plus, visit Brooklyn Ball Factory's sister restaurants, Momo Sushi Shack, Samurai Papa, Samurai Mama, Bozu, and Kitade Shokudo. Learn more at brooklynballfactory.com.
Are you enjoying our podcast? Heritage Radio Network has lots more. I'm Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And together we host Why Food, a podcast about innovators, career changers, and entrepreneurs who are changing the face of food.
How did these folks decide to hit the brakes, start over, and become inspiring chefs, entrepreneurs, farmers, and activists they are today?
Browse episodes of Why Food wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to get you to our next interview with Jose Arroyo in just a moment. First, I'd like to remind everybody, it has been a few weeks. So, as always, if you have not yet done it and would like to leave a rating or a review for us at Apple's podcast store or wherever you happen to listen to this show, we'd really appreciate it. If you're listening to us for the first time, I'd encourage you to subscribe on whatever platform you listen to your podcasts on. It's free. Everywhere you do that, it's free, and new shows will just drop into your queue every week. And I'd also encourage you to follow us on Instagram, at Chef Podcast is the handle, and that is the best way to keep up with announcements about what we're up to, both on the air and in personal appearances, which I don't have any to announce right now, but I will soon. So our second guest this week is Jose Arroyo. You might not know that name.
Jose wrote me a note. I'm kind of flabbergasted as I'm looking at this email from him because it's been almost a year. On August 15th, 2018, Jose wrote me a note. It begins, "Hi, Andrew. So I was listening to your last episode on the drive home with Bill Telepan. Towards the end of the show, you sent out a calling card for any person out there in the industry with maybe a different perspective on the restaurant world in our country." Now, this happens to be true. I don't do it that much anymore because I didn't get much return on it. But I have periodically said that if you're out there, even if you're not a famous person, but if you are in the business and you are in a kitchen and you think you'd be a good guest, this is the key part. If you think you'd be a good guest, shoot me a note. You never know. My email address is andrew@toqueland.com, TOQUELAND.com, or you can message me at that Instagram feed I mentioned, at Chef Podcast. I'm an easy guy to find. In any event, I used to put this call out more often. That's what Jose was referring to, picking up with his note. "I figured I am not anything like the people you have had on so far, so let me throw my name in the hat and see what happens." Well, what happened is I took him up on it. So the email went on. Jose was born in 1988. His parents had immigrated to this country, I think, earlier in the 1980s. Like a lot of people who end up in kitchens, he dropped out of college. He attended Le Cordon Bleu Culinary School in Pasadena, California. He then joined the Army Reserves, which was largely just to earn some money, but he had also had a lot of relatives who had actually served in the military. And then his note picks up after the reserves. "When I came back after a little over 6 months, I knew I needed to get back in the restaurant scene. I took a line cook job at a local deli, and I have been there since January of 2011. I manage it now along with two other managers. The restaurant is called Old World Deli, and it has been around for over 45 years in Covina, California. I help run their second store, and it has been open for 17 years. As a manager, I am in charge of ordering, training, cooking, cleaning, catering, orders, hosting weddings, you name it, we do it all. We try to give the best service we can, kind of like a fast casual place if it felt more like home. I would call that, as I do in this interview, a family restaurant. I love the guest you have on, but here in suburban California and many of the Californian cities that I grew up in, like Santa Ana and where I live now, Ontario, fancy dining is the Olive Garden, Red Lobster, and places like that. $20 for a plate of pasta is a lot to people here and to most Americans, I would think. I think I have a story about the majority of people that dine in America, or at least in Southern California." To which I would say, Jose, I think you're right on the first time. I think it's you have a story about the majority of people that dine in America. And I thought when I got this note that he also probably represents the majority of people who work in restaurants in this country. You know, a lot of our guests on this show, I think it is what most people generally want to hear. It's the names people do know. From a mercenary standpoint, it's the most likely to get me the biggest numbers of listeners. But, you know, it is sort of the one percenters or the two percenters or the five percenters of the industry that are mostly my guests on this show. And it's a big industry out there. I think Jose's point was very well taken. We started communicating, as I told him. I only do interviews face-to-face. So when I was out in Santa Monica this spring for the LA Chef Conference, we made a date the day after the conference. Jose drove down to Santa Monica. It took him a little more than 2 hours, which I appreciated. We sat down on a bench right off the boardwalk or the promenade. You will hear in this interview, you'll hear some lawn mowing machinery in the background. Not too loud. There's no trouble hearing the interview. Nothing like that. But we were outside on a beautiful spring morning in Santa Monica. And I think this is a terrific interview. I also think, as is often the case when I speak to people who are sort of outside the realm of cooks and chefs that I usually talk to, interview, spend time with, that I think people in the industry at different, I don't like to say different levels. I don't think that's the way to look at it. People who work in different types of restaurants have more in common than they have not in common. I think This interview in many ways is not that different from a lot of interviews on this show, but in many ways, I think it's poignantly different. And Jose, for your first interview, I think you did a great job. I think you were very comfortable on mic. And we just traded texts today, and he gave me some personal news. I don't know that I should be sharing it on air, so I won't. But it sounds like you have some nice things going on in your life, so I'm happy for you. And I actually believe all of you are going to enjoy this interview as much as you do any other interview on this show. So with that, this is my conversation with Jose Arroyo, recorded a couple of months ago outside on the promenade in Santa Monica, California. Here you go.
We're here on the beach in Santa Monica. This is not unusual for you.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
This is a treat for me. Yeah. But I'll have explained who you are in the intro, Jose, but I have to say, I think it was probably around the holiday time.
Yeah, it's almost about the holidays.
I put out a call on the show, and I said, you know, if you're out there, if you think you have a story, maybe you're not famous, but, you know, reach out, right? Yeah. And not many people did. You sent me an email. Fortunately, you were persistent because both your initial ones went to spam.
They really did go to spam.
Yeah, but I'm here looking at actually the first one, and I'll probably have read more of this in the intro to the show, but I want to, at the very end, you say, I love the guests you have on, but here in the suburbs, parentheses, Upland, California,
yeah,
and many of the Californian cities that I grew up in, like Santa Ana, where I live now, Ontario, fancy dining is the Olive Garden, Red Lobster, and places like that. $20 for a plate of pasta is a lot to people here, and to most Americans, I would think.
Yeah.
I think I have a story about the majority of people that dine in America, or at least in Southern California, which means you also have a story about, from your side, the people who cook for these people, right? And then you said some really nice stuff that I don't need to read. So that's your background.
Yes.
Your background's a lot more textured than that. Your parents have a great American story.
They do.
Yeah. You've been in the military.
I have.
Yeah. So I want to talk about all this.
I've kind of been all over. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm touching a lot of different avenues, I guess.
So let's start off. Tell me just how, tell me how you first got interested in cooking. Like, what was the thing that, when you think back on it now, what first kind of drew you toward the profession?
So, my mom was an amazing cook. My late mother, just the best of the family, you know? But she just made simple Mexican, you know, because I'm Hispanic. So, everything was just simple, you know what I mean? The earliest memories, my fridge always had salsa, some kind of a salsa, you know, of some kind.
And homemade or?
Homemade. Oh, always homemade. She never had canned. I mean, if it was canned something, it was probably like, I don't know, Campbell's soup or something that maybe when she was tired.
But Mexican stuff was always made.
Everything was
in-house.
Yeah, everything. Okay. I didn't even eat out as far as, I didn't go anywhere, how do you say it? Like regular restaurants. Mm-hmm. It's so weird how Hispanic people, or at least in my family, when we went to go eat out, we went to a Mexican restaurant.
Yeah.
Didn't make any sense. Like, we cooked all that at home.
And probably better.
And a lot better.
Yeah.
But it was like, you went out for the experience of going out with family.
Yeah.
And it was
maybe
probably
mom wanted a break.
Yeah. And it was probably just you know, if you go to a Mexican restaurant, they probably know Spanish. So it's probably a lot easier to order.
Okay.
So I guess maybe that had something to do with it. But yeah, I was always, I'm a big food lover, always have been. And so I think with just my mom being such a great cook, it's like I knew what good Mexican food was, always.
Now, for people who only know the sort of like, you know, Americanized or gringoized, you know, who don't know more about like the combination plate at a restaurant,
sure,
you know, taco, enchilada, rice, beans, you know, what's some stuff that you ate at home that maybe would be less obvious or less known to sort of your average American food person?
So both my parents are from Mexico, and they're from a city called Michoacán, the state of Michoacán, which is a little city called Huetamo. So all the food there is kind of like guisados or like stewed dishes and stuff.
Yep.
Not from everyone, but I'm sure they just have a tradition of those kind of meals.
Yes.
So if my mom made like a chicken dish, it was in like some sort of a salsa stew with maybe potatoes or something else to just kind of hearty it up. And then you had it with tortillas.
Yes.
Like
every meal and that I could even remember, like, there were tortillas at the dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was just...
That's the bread of...
Yeah, that's our bread.
The equivalent of the bread basket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and even now, like, it's funny because when you go to culinary school, they weed that out of you. They're like, I don't know.
French
food is like...
Yeah.
You always want to have bread and this and that. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's just a whole different style.
Yeah.
But...
So, at what age did you start thinking you might want to... What was your first job?
So
in a kitchen, or in a restaurant.
So I didn't. It's funny you say that. I didn't start cooking in restaurants till after culinary school.
Okay,
big mistake. Don't do that. Definitely work at a restaurant first. See if it's your deal.
Yeah,
and then if you want to pursue it, I say, boom, there's a door. You know, go right into it.
But, so your culinary school did not have a. Where'd you go to culinary school?
I went to Le Cordon Bleu.
Okay, which one?
Oh, you're right. So. In order to graduate, you have to get a job. So my first job in a kitchen was I worked at Olive Garden.
Okay.
You know, because it's easy to get hired there because they're so big, you know what I mean?
But, I mean, you did that. That was while you were in school. I'm saying you didn't – like the Culinary Institute is a prerequisite that you have to work in a kitchen before they'll take you.
Okay.
Right? And I think the reason is, and it's probably why you just said what you said, is – you know, cooking school is theoretical, right? It's like a laboratory. It's not the real world.
Science, really.
So you could go through all that and be like, oh, I really love these skills I'm developing. Yeah. But then when you get into the, I use this comparison and I don't mean any disrespect since you were actually served.
Yeah.
But I say it's like the difference between like training and combat. Yeah. Like it's not real until you're actually out
in
there
theater,
doing
it.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, culinary school, that's a whole bag of, you know. To me, it was very positive, I think, because I was younger.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I think when you get older, you start really seeing, I mean, school systems in general are, at the end of the day, there to make profit, you know, there to make money.
Yeah.
So once you know that, then it's like your mind kind of changes, you know, to the whole idea. So back to your question about...
What made you want to do it?
You know, it's so funny. So I graduate. So I went to a Cal State San Bernardino.
Mm-hmm.
I did a year there.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wasn't for me. Like, it just, I don't know what it was. It wasn't that the classes were hard. School to me has always kind of been easy.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like, I don't know if I was bored or whatever. Yeah. But I always wanted to cook for, I don't know why. It was what it was.
Professionally.
Yeah, I always wanted to cook professionally.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know why. I guess I never really thought about why did I want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I couldn't because I knew my dad wasn't going to be into it.
Because?
Like, Hispanic families, like, I mean, I'm first generation here. And, like, you know, it's like you want to be a lawyer, a doctor.
American dream.
Yeah, the American dream.
What did what did your dad do?
So my dad works in landscape.
Okay.
So he worked for, like, a nursery for, like, 11 years. And what's the city called? Dang, I can't remember.
That's okay.
But
so he was doing very physical work.
Yeah.
He's out there in the sun.
And he worked in the kitchen as well when he first got here.
That was
so
like
he's like, don't do that.
So he wanted to him that was
it was
something
like a lesser
he wanted you to have something better.
Yeah.
He probably was doing that so you could have
a
shot at something else.
Yeah.
And then you say that you want to do that.
I want to jump into the hardest thing.
Yeah.
You know, but I always say he did it to me because the whole time I was growing up, he would take me to go work, you know, with him. And so to me, I've been doing this since I was 11. Physical labor, just working, you know, working all day, working in the hot sun, you know.
So he didn't just bring you to hang out. He would actually have you do
there.
Stuff.
I was there to work.
Yeah.
And
starting at what age? Do you remember?
Probably like 11 or 10.
Yeah.
I remember at first I had a choice. It was like, hey, mijo, do you want to come with me? I'm going to go work on some houses today. And then I think it was like 11, 10 or 11. Yeah, I lost a choice. I was going to go. And so, but
there's nothing wrong with
who
that.
I am now. Yeah.
My father used to, for extra money, flip's the right words. He lived in an apartment building and he would like, you know, when a unit turned over, he would come in and paint it and whatever. And I remember very fondly like coming down and putting a radio on and like, painting with my father. Yeah. Like,
I just knock it out.
I like doing it.
Yeah. Oh, so you like, okay.
Yeah.
To me, it was
but it was about doing it with my dad, I think.
Yeah.
I didn't take any just like primal sort of personal. Yeah. I think it was like a father-son thing.
Yeah. Now it is. Like, now, I want to spend time with my dad whenever I can.
Yeah.
But, I think when you're growing up, your mentality is just like, oh, I want to go home or whatever.
So when you start going, you go to cooking school, you get this kind of traditional Western
style
education. What did you... I go back to this note you sent me, right? What did you have in mind? Like, okay, you wanted to do it, but did you just think, like, were you thinking in terms of you wanted to be a chef and have, like, a repertoire, or were you thinking, like, you want to go into a kitchen and that was just going to be your job?
So, during...
I'm wondering about this distinction you made when you wrote me between what you do and...
Now, and...
Because I actually don't think there is that big a distinction between what you do and what people now, who are very famous
do. In my mind,
do.
I know that, but... Mm-hmm. It's like, it's hard to explain to someone that maybe does know something about cooking, because they'll ask you, like, where do you work?
Yeah.
And if you tell them something that's not impressive, it's like,
next.
They'll just,
they zone out.
And it's like, well, that's not real. That's not kind of like what I said. Most people, 95%, maybe higher than that, of all of Americans or people just across the world, they don't go to fine dining restaurants.
Yes.
They just don't.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's a little, like, it's definitely real, but it's not as important as all these other restaurants that are feeding the masses.
Yes.
They're hitting so many more people than you that it's hard for you to ever, it's like, so you make these awards like, yes, your food is better or whatever, and it's going to be more amazing, but let's say I give you two plates of pasta. One comes from a fine dining place. One doesn't. Someone that doesn't care, that's just there to have a nice meal.
Mm-hmm.
They eat them both. Then you show them the price tag.
Mm-hmm.
They'll never come back to the one that's super duper expensive. They're just not going to.
Mm-hmm.
Because to them, it's like, well, it was better, but it wasn't that much better.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. Like, they work every day.
Yeah.
And most Americans, they know how much money's in their bank account.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, then... working at these fine dining places, you're never going to really be feeding Americans. You're just feeding people of privilege, I would say.
Yeah.
Not everyone.
No. Like, you and I were talking a minute ago about the, like the circuit that I've been on the last year, all these conferences and, I do see a lot of the same people and people have started referring to that crowd as the one percenters, of the food world.
Which makes sense.
Of the food world.
Yeah.
And I think that's valid, And I remember the very first episode of this show, Alex Stupak, who has the MPA on Restaurants, was on.
Love that book, by the way.
And his taco book?
His taco book.
So we had this, we were talking about something like very cerebral, right? Mm-hmm. And he interrupted himself and said, and by the way, 99% of the restaurants in the world don't give a shit about any of this, right?
Facts.
Meaning they're just... mom and pop places or whole, they're just restaurants that serve food that are providing a function. They try to do it well. Hopefully they have some sense of basic idea of hospitality.
Yeah.
They refill your water glass and they keep the place clean and they seem happy to see you when you walk in. Fundamentals, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't go much deeper than that. A lot of these people aren't concerned with signature dishes.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, definitely.
Which I think is what you're saying. The one exception I would say is I do think there is this class of like food enthusiasts who... they save up. They do culinary travel. Young cooks fall into
this
category.
Yeah, that's what I do.
They save up. I want to. It's like in a movie where a kid's saving up like for a guitar, or their first car. People save like that for a dining experience.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of the.
There's a niche there.
There's that little group of people who technically, if you say, can they afford this? No.
Yeah.
But they splurge on that. Instead of I've seen this in comment sections on the internet when people bug out about prices and they'll say, look, I have a used car that I'm driving into the ground and the money I would have used to buy a nicer car I spend on restaurants.
I wonder how much of that is now. I feel like my generation, all of my friends, I just turned 30.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone of my age group, like I only have one friend, him and his wife, that they just bought a house.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us are like, dang, it's like, at least here in SoCal, it just seems like such a big money wise, how do you even pay for that?
Yeah.
It's like, in other states, at least it's a little bit more reasonable.
Yes.
But here it's just like, what the heck? Like,
yeah.
How? Why is it that my generation just has so much less than our predecessors, like our parents? You know, my dad at my age already, you know, it seemed like he had the ball rolling a lot yes. sooner than me. And I'm, I don't want to say I'm more educated. Well, I am more educated. I went to more school, but
yeah.
It's like something there is not translating into us actually, you know,
yeah.
having more.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we're changing that, and now we want better experiences because mm-hmm. we're like, well, we can't have the house.
Right.
So, but I could definitely go to a really cool concert
yeah,
or
right.
dine at, you know.
Yeah.
It seems that for whatever
if
reason.
You pick your spots.
Yeah, my generation yeah. is like, I'm just going to travel and I'm yeah. going to go see the world.
Yes.
And I don't know how much of that is my generation or if it's because of the lack of money, like we just can't find the jobs.
Yeah, I don't know how to disentangle it. I do know that there's definitely more of a premium, I think, for people your age and a little older on experience versus possessions.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know,
it's like I have no inkling to ever have a really expensive car.
Mm-hmm.
Just I don't.
Yeah.
Like if I'm gonna buy a car, I'm gonna buy cars. So it gets me to work, gets me back. It's nice. You know, if it.
Yeah.
That's really all I need it to serve.
Yes.
Other than that.
Yeah.
It just sits outside
yeah.
and gets dirty.
Yeah, I get it.
It's like buying nice shoes. Like you walk, they hit the ground
yeah.
every step.
Yep.
It is what it is.
Tell me, when did you go into the, you went into the army?
Yeah, so I went
when
into.
When did you do that?
Yeah, so I wanted to go active, but my mom was totally against that. She was like, no, you're not going to go. Because this was in, late 09 when I started thinking about it. I didn't actually get into.
So you were just about 20.
Yeah, I was just about 20. And I didn't go. It takes a little while. My MOS was, you know.
What's that?
It's your job, whatever your job is. I was a human resource specialist.
Okay.
So that was my job for the military. And I just wanted it so it could help me pay for the culinary school that I had gone to.
Okay.
Because I figured out that they'd help you out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did pretty well in my ASVAB that they make you take there.
Yeah.
And so I got like $15,000 and pretty much used all that to go mm-hmm. to my culinary school that I had already paid for.
Okay.
Because I quickly realized that while I was working at Olive Garden, even though I was full time, it just like I was not going to make enough money to pay off
mm-hmm.
just a student loan debt alone. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, and I was kind of hard headed. Like I didn't want help from my parents.
Yeah.
I just wanted to do it by myself.
Yeah.
I've always been like that. And yeah, I quickly realized that was not going to happen without some sort of help.
So tell me about, you go to work at the Olive Garden, mm-hmm. right? Now what, you know, for people who've never worked at a place like that,
yeah.
right? What is that kitchen like? Who's cooking there?
Yeah.
And how invested are they in what they're doing? You know, because they're turning out dishes that are like handed to them from like the Death Star.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like they don't see the person who came up with it or, you know,
yeah, yeah.
or who wrote the recipe.
They don't get to dictate how.
There's no expression.
It. No, not
yes.
at all. But you don't want it. You don't want there to be, because when you walk into an Olive Garden, you want it to be the
consistent.
Same experience
exactly.
you had somewhere else.
So what is that? How does that affect? I'm just curious. What's like the mindset in the kitchen yeah. there?
It's very different than even where I work now. So going from culinary school, where all I wanted to do was work in fine dining. I think everyone there wants to work in fine dining because that's the goal.
Like you did.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, definitely I did. I thought that's what I was going to drive me.
Now, when you say fine dining, you mean like the French Laundry,
yeah,
like you're talking about, like,
and yeah, yeah.
That was in your
that's
at some
I
point
thought,
that
I
was
thought
in
that
your,
was cooking.
Okay,
you know,
right?
But I think because I was so young. I was
mm-hmm.
19, 20, mm-hmm. 20 years old when I graduated
yeah.
culinary school, and so it's like you're very impressionable. Anyone could kind of like manipulate you the way
yes.
to think the way they want you to think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even really think you become a person until you're like 25 or 26. You start mm-hmm. having your own ideas,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I got lost in what you're talking about. Oh, so
the fine dining versus the Olive Garden.
Yeah. So you would be surprised by just how lovely the people are. And they're the reason those restaurants work. I mean, if it was just, they couldn't do it without those people. Like, these aren't like the McDonald's employees. These are I hate to say it, but most of them, at least in the Olive Garden, it was almost everyone in the kitchen was all his, all Mexican people.
Mm-hmm.
Every single person, from the dishwasher to whoever, like the last cook.
Mm-hmm.
And they take so much pride in their work.
Mm-hmm.
So just being able, they come in on time, they come in early, you know, they stay a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they, at the Olive Garden, they give you a recipe. This is the recipe. You got to make it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm talking about the prep people now. They come in. They take pride in being able to do the do it quickly, efficiently, clean.
Yeah.
You know, everything that you want, actually, from any cook from
any kitchen.
Any kitchen. Yeah. It's just that to them, their drive isn't, oh, the customers are so happy with my work. Their drive is, I'm feeding my family.
Mm-hmm.
I have a job. I'm in a better place than I was.
Mm-hmm.
This is 10 times better than if I hadn't come here in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And what more do you need?
Mm-hmm.
Really? As far as a drive, that's more drive than most people, you know, they want, they're looking for all these accolades. Like that's just keeping yourself happy.
These are the people I call career cooks, lifers, people who they're not, it's like what you're describing. These aren't people who are there as a stepping stone to becoming a chef. These aren't people who are keeping notebooks at home.
Yeah.
With you know, the menu they're going to do when they this is a job.
They have no desire of opening.
Yeah,
their, well, some of them do, but I'm just saying, for the most part, as long as they get paid well,
yes,
and they're happy. They're happy to do the job.
Yeah,
most of the, well, actually, every cook on the line when I finally got to cooking there had a second job at another chain. So it was like you worked for Olive Garden, then you also worked for the Macaroni Grill.
Is that right?
And yeah. Oh yeah.
Was that wasn't against company policy?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
As long as it's not for Olive Garden, it's the Darden company.
Okay.
I think at the time, I don't know if things have changed. At the time, you just couldn't work for another Darden company.
Interesting.
So you couldn't work at Red Lobster and Olive Garden because those are both the same company. But you could work at Denny's or whatever you wanted.
Yeah.
And a lot of people did.
Yeah,
because you because a lot of the times for cooks, because those kitchens can't work you 12, 16 hours.
Yeah,
they have to work you 8.
Yeah.
Or 4, whatever your shift is, 6 hours. Sometimes the night shift is.
Yeah.
So then, you, in order to get those hours that you need, because you're not making a lot of money, so you need more time in your job in order to pay the bills.
Yeah. So is there? In those kitchens, is there someone who is designated the chef?
No. So you have managers, and then there is like a managing, just like someone that, at least when I was there, that just took care of the kitchen pretty much. Made sure the plates went out, made sure everything was done to standard, made sure that things were being cooled down and treated properly.
Is anyone expediting, or is it just is it all like orders come in off a POS machine? And,
so, yeah, it's all
and then
POS.
They just go up in the window, and there's sort of no liaison between the front and the back.
Usually it'll be a manager
or
the cook manager that'll be taking out, that'll be expediting.
Okay.
You're going to have really good servers that could do it. You know, you're always going to have the talented servers that could go and go through all the orders and make sure that everyone gets their food on time.
But these kitchens, it sounds like, have more in common with a McDonald's the overall business, there are servers, right?
Yeah.
So there is a front of house staff. You don't have that at McDonald's. Hmm. But in terms of kitchen operation, this actually sounds much closer to me to fast food than to a restaurant.
As far as
a full service
everything
restaurant.
Is pre, like, so how do you explain? So let's say I was working at a more expensive restaurant or something.
Yeah.
You probably have more control over your whatever your station is that day.
Yeah.
Right? It's pretty much your station.
Yeah.
Well, they can't do that because, one, Olive Garden doesn't want there to be any errors or mistakes. So they just put things in place to take care of that. So let's say the guy that's cooking the pasta in the morning, he's the only guy cooking the pasta. He cooks the pasta for the whole day. For the whole restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And that way it stays consistent because this guy, that's what he does. He cooks the pasta.
Yeah.
Right? The guy that comes and makes the Alfredo in the morning, the same guy that makes the Alfredo every single time. So you still have the same, things are still being controlled, but because you gave someone the task and you let them learn, they're not robots. Like they still are cooks. Yeah, they are cooks. Yeah. You know, they still have a recipe and they're going to follow it because that's a job. But
because they wanted to, they could probably. Yeah. I mean,
it's not
like
a microwave. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, a place like that could probably be automated if they wanted to. Probably at this point in history.
I think you would lose something though. I don't know. I haven't worked there in years. Yeah. But I think you would lose something because at least when I was there, like. You could tell, like, if the guy that made the, you know, the marinara or whatever, like, if he didn't come in, it's like, I don't know, this one's not as same as the regular guy that makes it. So there was still
the human factor.
Exactly. There was still a lot of cooking definitely being done.
Yeah.
Even if it wasn't at the level of, you know.
Okay. So you, well, so what was the moment when you took your, you know, where you kind of took your eyes off the fine dining target and decided you weren't going to go that route?
I think, you know, my problem has always been that I see things, I'll just be, if it seems too risky, it just not, to me, I'm like, you've had people on the show that are like, oh, I just picked up everything and left.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what? What do you mean you picked up everything and left? I was like, what about your family and where are you going to sleep? And like, all that's in my, like, I don't just, I make a calculated decision and then I go and do the thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't just. Like, I would have nowhere... Yeah, it just... It's crazy. Like, one of the interviews you just had, he's like, oh, yeah, I just slept on a mattress that they just laid out for me. I was like, oh. I was like, that doesn't make... I mean...
Oh, on the houseboat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said, well, okay, in my mind, I was like, yeah, maybe when I was... Maybe I should have done it when I was 20 or 21. It made more sense then. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't make more sense. The older you get, the less appetite... Like, the less... what is it called?
The less tolerance for risk?
Yeah. Because you've gotten to an age where, like, well, you know what? My life's not that bad.
Yeah.
I'm doing fairly well.
Yes.
You know?
Okay.
But
did you, like, did you have a time where you were, like, cooking your own stuff at home and developing?
Oh, I do,
like,
every day.
You still do?
Oh, every...
Do you have your own repertoire of, like, Jose's dishes?
So, that's funny to say that. My wife hates this because she'll tell me, make that thing you made last time. But I almost have zero interest in remaking something that I already made. Like, so...
If you got it right, I'm assuming.
Yeah, if I got it right. So I make it, taste delicious, I jot it down. Oh, cool. It's in my head now. Like, that's how that goes. Or I make something, I'll make the same thing, but I'll put a twist on it. I'm like, what if I had done it this way?
Mm-hmm.
It might or might not... to me, it's like a science experiment. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's all... My only passions in life are, like, science and cooking.
Science?
Yeah.
So talk to me about that. What's that about?
Oh, I love it. I mean, everything.
Is that what you thought you were going to study in school?
Yeah. I thought I was going to be maybe, like, an engineer and into the sciences. I always liked, like, astrobiology. Like, that drives me. I think, like, the stars and just the galaxy's crazy.
Mm-hmm. You still read up on this stuff or watch documentaries?
Oh, yeah. My podcasts are like food things and then science things.
Okay.
Because I just think that's awesome. I think if you stop learning, what are you even doing?
Well, I agree with that. But, you know, what's interesting to me is you're now maybe, I think I went, you know, 5 decades into my life and never, well, I must have met some and I just didn't know it. But I was never, to my knowledge, met a chef who had an engineering background, right? And you're maybe now the 5th person who's been on the show in the last 6 months who's
brought up the sciences.
Who's brought up engineering specifically as either a career they were in or a career that they, maybe not all
they
on
had
the
an
show.
Interest
some of this was some articles. I just interviewed a chef in San Francisco who switched careers at 27, but he was an engineer. That's what he was doing
at that age. It's
Alex
crazy.
Harris, who was on the show in December, who has he's the chef at Emma's Torch, engineer. I had a culinary student on recently who's a career changer, Alicia Matthews, engineer. What this? It's so interesting to me because I think it speaks to, like, how does that translate into, like, what do you take from that to the kitchen? It seems to me like that's more about the pragmatic part of the work than the sort of creative or expressive part of the work. Like, are you really good in your job at, like, you're in a managerial level now.
Yeah.
Are you really good at setting up systems? Are you really good
at
keeping...
That's my favorite thing.
Okay, so that's the engineering piece.
Yeah, my favorite thing is
okay, this is the way it should be done, okay? If you think that it should be done a different way,
yeah,
tell me about it. We'll try it. If it doesn't work,
yeah,
we'll just go, we'll go back.
Yeah.
There's no reason. I hate people that'll just, you'll ask them, hey, why did you make it like that? Or,
did you hear that?
What'd he say?
Hate's a strong word.
Oh.
Some dude, we are in California.
We are in California.
Some
and this
dude
is,
just
you know,
walked by. We're on the promenade here. Some dude walked by, overheard that, and said, hate's a strong word.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry. About trying out something.
Maybe it was a strong word.
About trying out something new.
Dang, I lost my train of thought.
If somebody has an idea for doing something better, you'll try it.
Yeah, we'll try it. And
but you were going to say you hate what? People who won't try new things?
Yeah, I hate... If you ask someone... Now my head is like, is hate really a strong word? So... you ask... This happened to me a lot when I was even in culinary school, or just when you start working with people, with other cooks or people that have cooked something for a long time, they'll just tell you, well, just do it because I said.
Yes.
Or
that's how it's done. Don't question it.
Yeah, don't question it. You just do it because, like, what do you mean because you said?
Yeah.
What if it could be better?
Yeah.
They're not even thinking it could improve.
Yes.
I'm not saying that everything will improve, but I'm just saying don't be so close-minded that you already figured it all out when in reality you probably don't even have a clue.
So was the military difficult for you in this level? Because that's not generally understood to be an environment where they're looking for feedback.
You have to shut some brain parts up.
Yeah.
And the cool thing is I always had great NCOs. I had great sergeants that really allowed, you know, if you question something, they would agree. Like, you know what? I don't know why the heck we're here so early, but we're here. And you're right. That's the mentality you got to have.
Yeah.
You know, in the military, I would have to say. Like, you just, you don't really have a voice there. You just have to follow the rules.
Yeah. You're part of an organism.
Yeah. And you have to understand that.
Yeah.
Your team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just that,
but that, was that hard for you?
No, not at all.
You loved it.
Yeah. I loved it. Because it's just like sports.
Yeah.
And I was a football. I played football all through high school. And it's exact.
What position?
I played corner, linebacker, receiver.
Okay.
So
were you good?
I was pretty good.
Did you ever get injured? Or?
I knew I could never be a star or whatever. And so it's so funny now if you just put, you never think about your life. So... Because I knew I could never go anywhere, well, okay, I'll just do something where I know I could go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It just made more sense to me to do that than I'm not 6'3", and you know what I mean? I was pretty fast, but...
That was your answer to, I said, did you ever get injured?
Oh, yeah. I did eventually for the most, but not during high school. No,
okay.
I was pretty... I broke a couple fingers, but nothing...
Nothing crazy. Long-term, nothing terrible. Long-term. Okay.
I was pretty safe.
So with this food that you make at home, like your own stuff, which way does it lean? Does it recall your mom's food, or is it how would you define your style of stuff?
So I try to make everything as simple as possible,
mm-hmm.
as healthy as possible now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm everything now is like trying to get more leafy greens, mm-hmm. trying to get just, I think that's just the standard now. You want things that taste really good,
mm-hmm.
but aren't gonna, you know, add a ton of weight.
Yeah.
I make, so a lot of my food is Mexican or Asian, and it's like my two loves of cuisines, you know,
mm-hmm.
I just think they're undervalued, underappreciated,
mm-hmm.
and like the bang for your buck value is just there almost every time.
Now in the Asian, realm, any particular countries that you gravitate toward?
So, you know, I think more of the dishes as opposed to the style, because like I really like, I like sushi, but I would just not mess with sushi.
Yeah.
It's not my forte.
Yeah,
but I love ramen.
Okay.
Like ramen drives me crazy. I love
soups. So you make ramen.
Yeah, so I make a lot of ramen. I make hot pot. I make so now we're going to another realm.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm doing Chinese, I do I have a thing of Szechuan peppercorns at the house because they're delicious and they're different. You know, it's like it's all about trying things that are a little bit different.
Yeah.
Than you're used to, and then kind of. I hate fusion. I hate the word fusion, but I get it.
Yeah.
I understand what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
You know?
But you don't do that.
I do.
You do?
But I just hate... to me...
Do you go like intercontinental? Like, will you mingle Mexican food with like something like Thai?
So that's my problem. That's my biggest problem. When you say, so this is Chinese or this is Mexican or what are we really asking? So like, all this food is on
One planet. It's on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Potatoes. So if I say, think about potato dish, maybe you go to like, was it Ireland? You know, mm-hmm. they're big on potatoes mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Well, potatoes come from South America.
Mm-hmm.
Chili's South America. Mm-hmm. Tomatoes, South America. But if you think tomato, a tomato dish, you might think like a spaghetti.
Yeah.
Well, it's not even, they just, it's been there for such a long time
yes.
that it, they made it of the place.
Yes.
But I think you're taking something away when you say, this is, because this ingredient, so let's say I said Szechuan peppercorn. Because I'm using Szechuan peppercorns, then it has to be Asian. Like, the Szechuan peppercorn didn't decide that it wanted to be Asian. Like, we gave it that
right.
title, you yeah. know?
Right.
So, I totally understand. There is Chinese, there is Mexican.
Yeah, I was
it.
Just asking if yeah. you, so it sounds like the question is yes.
Yes.
You do mingle what most people would consider to be different cuisines.
Yeah, I yeah. do.
But definitely. You don't look at it that way.
I definitely, yeah, because it's just a, I think you're narrowing the scope. I think it's easier to explain to someone what the dish is.
Yes.
But how about, hey, try his food because it's delicious.
Yeah.
Not because he's making this cuisine and that cuisine yeah. and he's melding them together.
So
it's more about respecting the yeah. actual ingredient.
So than, are you an intuitive cook? Like, when you, do you just kind of see what's around and go for it?
Pretty much every time.
Okay.
Unless there's something that I'm craving. Like
yeah.
if I'm craving ramen, then, you know, it just depends. Do I want to make like a tonkotsu or mm-hmm. do I want to go shio? Or maybe I don't want to do any of that. I just want to make a dashi, but I'm going to make like a Mexican style
mm-hmm.
Broth,
yes.
you know, with a lot of, you know, yeah. chilies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah.
Nothing. I'm just taking, you know.
So tell me about this. You know, you described in the note you sent me, the place where you work, you referred to it as a deli.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't, at least as a New Yorker, it doesn't compute. Because then you went into, like, catering, and I think you yeah. even said weddings. And
we do weddings.
And, yeah, and, yeah, and the hot food there. So, I mean, for me, a deli is a place with a counter, and they make sandwiches and maybe hot sandwiches. Mm-hmm. Maybe in the morning you can get an egg sandwich off a grill.
Yeah.
And maybe there's some tables, maybe there's not. But tell me, describe this place to me.
So, how could I say? I guess it's more like a... What's the term? It's like a casual,
like a what's family, like a, like a family,
like a Chipotle, like a
fast casual,
like a fat. It's like a fast casual,
okay.
but a little bit more towards family oriented,
like a family restaurant,
like a family restaurant. Yeah,
they have their own menu.
So we have our own menu.
There's
yeah.
table service.
Mm-hmm.
Does the menu change?
Never changes.
Are there specials?
There are specials every day, but. It's like a, it's like
there's a repertoire
yeah,
specials.
There's a repertoire.
Okay.
Yeah, once you know them, you know them.
Okay.
You order at the counter.
Yep.
And then you just pick it up. Either if we're not that busy, we'll bring it to you. But if
yes.
we're busy, just come pick it up at the counter.
Uh huh.
I always thought it was crazy that to get someone to bring you the food, like now it's like an extra charge. It's like
mm-hmm.
I really love the hospitality is included because
mm-hmm.
it should be. I think
mm-hmm.
you walk into a restaurant, you should feel like you're at home.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's just always.
So, and your role there is what technically?
So I manage. So I manage a staff. So
okay.
the front of the house and the back of the house.
So you manage the
cooks
business.
and the servers.
Okay.
Yeah. But in you know I also open the restaurant. I close the restaurant. So because we're so small, it's I think we're 18 employees right now.
Mm.
So you
that
do
is
everything.
Small.
Everyone does everything.
Is it just, breakfast, lunch, dinner?
We don't have a breakfast, but we open at 10.
Okay.
So if you wanted to get there early and have a sub or something,
yeah.
you could.
Uh-huh.
Or just a
and
soup.
What time do they close, like, during the
we
week?
We close at 8, except on Sundays when we close at 7.
Okay.
So it's just, if you think about a deli, delis usually close early.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that.
So you, and you, so you open,
mm-hmm.
which means what? How early are
so
you
if
in
I,
there? You, for the place to be open at 10 a.m., what
so
time
for
are
the
you
man,
there?
So there's only 3 managers.
Yeah.
One of them has been there for like 26 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that just our company, because we have 2 restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
Man, we have some people that have been there for 35
mm-hmm.
years. It's just like an institution.
There mm-hmm. Is there any generational employee? Like, are there any families
so
where
the,
like the kids
the owner,
work
yeah, the,
there too?
The original owner, his kids run it now.
Yeah.
And one of their kids now is kind of stepping
on
up.
On the ownership side.
On the ownership
okay,
side.
Okay, but there's
She's
no employees
just,
who have like bred new employees, for lack of a better term.
You know, that's a good question. Maybe there is.
Okay.
I would have to ask. Our other
curious.
Location's a little bit bigger, so
okay.
I would have to ask.
Okay.
But, yeah, so the style of restaurant that I work in now just keeps me occupied the whole time. Because there's no... So if I open, I'm there at 6 in the morning, right? Sometimes a little bit early if all the deliveries are coming in. And you're leaving at like 4. If I'm closing, I'm getting there at like 11:30, and I'm there till about 9, 9:30. So it's nice to have that where one day all I'm doing is just prep, cooking, taking care of the, you know, all the back of the house. And then another day, it's all about customer service and, you know, waiting on people and just... When you're in the front, it's all about relationships. You like 90% of my customers I see on a weekly basis. It's wild.
You like that part of it?
Oh, I love it. That's that's the
you
best
seem
part.
Like you, I mean, when we met today right off, you're like you got a very easy energy about you.
Thank you. And I'm low energy right now. I am really dry.
You drove like 2.5 hours to meet me.
Because you're just seeing taillights the whole time. And it's like there's something about that that like the repetitiveness. Just
if this was
like,
a longer trip, I would have met you halfway, but I, I'm
no, no, it's
home
okay.
tomorrow.
Not at
already.
All. Yeah. Like I said, who am I? I'll drive.
Well, you're Jose Arroyo.
Thank you.
Okay. So what, tell me about the some of the large scale stuff you guys do. So, all right, so catering might entail what?
All right. So it all depends on the customer. So every day, let's say. That's the cool thing about our restaurant. Our scope is huge. Because you do we do weddings. We have like an office that's like offshore oil rigging company. And their office is like, I don't know how many employees, a couple thousand employees they must have. And sometimes on a weekly basis, we will deliver to them maybe 2 or 3 times a week for 20 people, for 30 people, for 10 people. And it's just like a constant. So they'll want sandwiches, or they'll want roasted chicken, or they'll want lasagna, or whatever. It all depends. It's nice to have, you know, because our menu is pretty big, and we do everything pretty. I would like to say we do everything pretty well. Maybe not, you know, Michelin level, but you know, you get a good amount of food for the value. For weddings, it all depends on the customer. Sometimes they say, you know what, this is a they're very nice people, and their budget is low. They just want good food. They want it to be hot. They want it to be ready. And they're just going to serve themselves buffet style. Cool. Not a problem. We'll do that. Do you want us to come bus tables? Do you want us to serve for you? Do you want whatever you want? We'll do it for you.
And then you have what? Like people you contract for that?
So
extra staff?
Because we've been around for over 50 years, you get a lot of people that maybe don't work in the restaurant anymore, maybe have retired, but still want a little bit of money on the side, and so you give them a call.
So that's your that's your expandable workforce.
And sometimes, I mean, for us at least, like I just did a wedding last Saturday. I'm doing a wedding this Saturday. Last Saturday it was 85. No, no, a hundred. It seemed like it wasn't that many people there, but I think they cater for like 125 people. But it didn't seem like it was that many people, and it was only two of us, and we knocked it out because we just. You set yourself up for success, right? So they wanted an hors d'oeuvre hour. Cool. You make all that ahead of time. What do you got to do? You just open it all up, ready for the people to eat. You, while they're doing the hors d'oeuvres, you set up all the hot food. Okay. Clean everything up. Now we're going to, you know, it's a production. You're just, you're there.
Yeah.
You just make your presence known, make sure you're polite and nice to everyone. And
so it's funny, you know, on this show, we talk a lot about, you know, people. Just recently, we've talked to a few people about like this, like being like addicted to adrenaline.
Oh, yeah.
You seem like the opposite to me.
Really?
Yeah, you seem like someone who likes it really tight, really controlled, no surprises. Am I wrong?
Oh yeah. When I love having like 10 tickets on the board and then like two more that I haven't even touched, cuz like I love the adrenaline of just like getting it done. But
do you work better under pressure?
Yeah, but I don't get this. It's funny. I have one of our food reps. I'm like, I got lasagna and all this other stuff for maybe 25 people. I got someone in the back cutting chicken. I'm doing the orders. I got a line to the door, and the food guy will come in. And he goes, "Oh, he's stressing out." And I'm like, "Hey, man, how've you been? How's the weekend?"
Right.
Oh, okay, cool. Because you get into a routine where, it's all okay. You know, as long as. I don't like stressing out. If you're stressing out, why? Why are you doing it then?
But I also think, I mean, I've never cooked professionally. I've obviously never been a professional athlete, but I do play a lot of tennis. There is a thing that happens in competitive sports. I believe it happens in kitchens. not literally, obviously, but time slows down.
It does.
When you're the person in the thick of it, time slows down. Mm-hmm. So you, someone might come in, like this person you're describing, they don't understand the plane of reality that you're in at that moment. Yeah. You actually have it under control. Yeah. And it probably from the outside seems like something unmanageable.
It seems hectic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or undoable, impossible.
Yeah.
I've seen the impossible happen a lot in kitchens. You know, you come in and people have X amount of time to make something happen. I did an interview recently on this show with the two women at King Restaurant, Claire and Jess, right? And you can hear at the end, they're like, what time is it? And I said, it's 11:15. And Jess was like, oh, my God, because they were opening for lunch in 15 minutes. Now, I got out of the way, but I know she was about to go into one of these, you know, into like beast mode and just make it happen. I don't know what she had to do, but I'm sure it got done.
Yeah.
And I, as a civilian, would, I'm sure, not have been able to do it.
You know, it's,
there's that gear.
It's because you, even in my head sometimes, honestly, even in my head sometimes, I'm like, I don't think I'm going to be able to do it. You know, I've had it where, let's say, I actually just had this the other day. We made a pizza, and for whatever reason, my cook didn't put one of the toppings on it. So we took it out. The customer looking is like, oh, it doesn't have pepperoni. I was like, I got three people waiting, one of my people slicing meat so they can't help me out the register. The other person is already working on someone, and I'm like, I see my cook. My cook's busy. He can't make this pizza. So in my head, I'm like, you have to be polite. You know what? We're going to take care of you right now. If you just give me 10 or 15 minutes, I'll knock this pizza out for you. And in my head, I'm like, I don't know how the heck I'm going to do this. But then you do it.
Yeah.
Because you don't have a choice. The choice isn't there. You just, you have to do it.
Yeah, it's like I said, you can see the impossible happen. Yeah.
It's weird. I guess I never really
thought
about
that. But you see that in athletics, too. You know, you'll see moments where, like if you watch a replay of something, you'll see it in basketball, you see it in football. It looks like the gap that someone who maybe pulls off an interception or someone who actually completes a pass or somebody who makes an incredible rebound, or in tennis, someone who hits an incredible volley. Oftentimes, in the moment before that happens, it
looks impossible.
It looks like too big a distance is going to get covered, right? And then you play it back, and it happens.
It just happens, whatever it is.
Yeah, there That's was this, I forget the ending. There was a, I don't watch really football, but there was a Super Bowl a couple years ago, and there was an interception on the last play of the game. Right, like in the end zone.
Yes. What Super Bowl was this? Why can't I think?
It was maybe 3 years ago.
Okay.
But then someone on Twitter posted a picture of where the guy who made the interception was standing when the quarterback
threw the ball.
Was throwing the ball. The ball was still on his fingertips, the quarterback's. And the person tweeted said, this doesn't look so stupid when you see it in this moment, right? Yeah. And then when you went back and watched it, it was, how did he close that gap? Yeah. But that's, I mean, that's adrenaline, that's will, that's calling on all your, you know, they say we only use X percent of our brain. I think we don't use all of, most of our abilities most of the time.
I always wondered how much of that, because that happens so very often, that sometimes, well, let's say he doesn't make the play, then it goes the other way.
Right.
So there's no... So maybe the reality is that the variables don't matter because all we're looking at is the end result.
Yeah.
So whatever the end result is, then we're going to backtrack.
Yeah.
Huh.
Right.
That's interesting.
It is interesting. So, I mean, you're 30?
I just turned 30 a couple months ago, and I don't feel 30, but I definitely...
You're talking to a 51-year-old, so you're not going to get any sympathy.
No sympathy.
No sympathy here. Go ahead.
But, that's the problem. Everyone, I think, when you think about when you were younger, when you're 30, you're like, oh, I was going to have it all. I was going to have whatever the dream was, you're going to have it, right? For me, I want to have my own restaurant. I want a house, all these things. And then you get here and I'm like, oh, God. Okay. So still working on this. You know what I mean? But the more I've thought about it, it's like, well, am I happy? I have good health. My wife's okay. Just had a baby. You know what? We're doing okay. We're going to figure this out.
Right.
Not a problem.
Yeah. But so when you said you feel, I thought you meant physically.
Yeah.
You didn't feel 30.
Yeah, well, waking up sometimes is definitely, not as easy.
You've got a newborn at home.
But, yeah, definitely.
But But so what I was going to ask is, you know, what is it for you right now? Like, what, when you think about the future, I mean, 30's really young. I mean, it's really young.
Maybe to me it doesn't feel young.
Yeah, no, I know it doesn't. But yeah. I even feel like right now, like I have new things going on. Like, I'm this close to taking up guitar. Right?
Ooh, that's hard.
Yeah,
that's
but hard. I think I'm going to do it.
Yeah,
you know,
do it.
Like you were saying, learning new things.
Yeah,
right?
You got to always. Yeah,
yeah. I've never played an instrument. I think I'd like to. You know, and I feel like I have time to get really good at it.
Yeah,
you know,
I play the worst instrument.
What do you play?
I play accordion. Don't ask me why I did that.
Why? How'd that happen?
My dad, when I was really young, and I see, always listen to your parents. My dad was like, "What do you want to play? The accordion or the guitar?" And I was like,
why
the
was
accordion.
It those two?
Hispanic. Like is it, yeah, you just find it at parties and
restaurants.
Yeah, for whatever reason, when I was a little kid, I just thought the accordion was the coolest thing.
Yeah.
And you know, here's the thing: we're sitting at a beach right now. If I had a guitar. More magical. An accordion isn't going
to
get
you. Be annoying.
You.
People might ask you to stop with the accordion. People might give you some money if you were playing guitar.
Yeah, and I don't play it well because I stopped playing it really young. But
yes. Yeah. One should. But sorry, any accordion playing listeners.
No
but,
polkas.
But what do you think? Do you want your own place at some point? Like, do you have like a 5-year plan? I don't want to say anything that's going to get you in hot water with your employer.
No, definitely. But, so me and my boss and great guy, his name's Cosmo. We've been in cahoots. His thing is, so he wants to step away. He's 60 now. He wants to kind of step away, but he wants to make sure that his baby is taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And we're there. I mean, me and the other managers, we want to keep it going.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in talks about opening another one. Maybe I just run that one. And then the problem is, like with any place, you have to be able to staff it well.
Yeah.
Staff makes or breaks your place, man.
Yeah.
Every single day, we get someone valuable that leaves. I just have someone that's leaving right now for a vacation for a while. It hurts because you have to now, you train someone so well, they do an excellent job, and then they go and do something else, you know, because a lot of the times, you know, my restaurant's not per se. It's not all these, you know, it's not a linea. It's not the people coming in here. This isn't their primary job.
Mm-hmm.
Or this isn't their dream.
Yeah.
So you have to motivate them in order for them to do a good job. But once you motivate them and once you get them to understand, look, you see all these people that are coming in, they enjoy what we do. If you get them to buy in that what you're doing is a good thing, it makes everything 10 times better.
Yeah.
If someone comes in, they have a bad attitude, blah, 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 blah. Look, the customer doesn't need to hear that.
Yeah.
That's not... They're not here for that.
No.
You know, if you need to discuss it, we'll discuss it after work. Yeah. But while you're here, you're working.
Yeah.
It's harder. I think regular restaurants like mine just have a harder time staffing good employees because a lot of people just don't care as much. And to be honest, these like young 18-year-olds straight out of high school, they don't even know how to sweep. Andrew, they don't know how to sweep.
Mm-hmm.
You know how annoying it is to have to pay someone almost here now, almost $15 an hour, and they can't sweep.
Yeah,
like whoa, that's wild. It's wild.
How
to
do
me.
You not sweep?
I'm not lying to you. I have this guy. He came in.
I've done that.
He's
in
doing
jobs.
Better.
I've done the.
He was pushing.
Go ahead.
He was pushing it with the broom, like pushing it. I was like, "That's not how you sweep." He's like, "Oh, well, I've never swept before."
Wow.
Okay. All right. Well, this is where we're at.
Wow.
But you have to, you know, you take a couple steps back, you take a deep breath, and go, "Okay."
Yes.
Here we go.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's every... I feel like every employee that comes in, at least in my restaurant, we treat them as if they know nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They will grow as fast or as slow as they want, depending on how much they know.
Mm-hmm.
I have people that come in, they're outstanding. I don't have to baby them. I don't have to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's not everyone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's the latter. But that's okay.
What's the next thing you're cooking at home? Do you know?
Today?
Well, at home. General? The next thing you're going to try out. Do you have any sense?
So yesterday I made a
like
chicken
getting ready to, that you're gearing up to try.
So I just started doing like incorporating fruits into the salsas.
Okay.
So I did like a mango salsa thing, and I made a guisado with that. That's really good. You take some in Mexican cooking. We have like dried meat. It's kind of like jerky, and because it's dried, you kind of have to rehydrate it, or you got to eat it like jerky. And in this, I made this mango, I don't even know what to call it. It's like a mango salsa, I guess. And so good. I mean, so good. Tender. It was best tacos I made in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm always trying.
my biggest thing now with the internet, whatever you want to learn, it's available to you.
Yeah.
You know, it just wasn't the case. Like, I wish when I was young, when I was going into culinary school, I wish I had the internet, because it would have taught me so many other things.
No, it's an amazing resource.
You know?
I mean, it really is.
Yeah.
I mean, because what you can get is, I mean, the, for me, it's the demos.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Stuff that you just can't get from a book. You know, you maybe you could used to be able to get it on a television show. But now, I mean, if you you can learn anything.
You can learn anything.
I want to make this kind of, you know, sausage or this kind of charcuterie or this. I want to learn how to make cheese.
Yeah.
You know,
and you can.
And you can find it.
You can order everything
online.
And probably
the exact one you want to make, too.
I had, I just had the discussion. One of my friends or one of my employees, he wants to be a music major. And so he's already been going to college and he's doing his thing, and he wasn't able to get some of the classes that he needed.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to have to take a couple months kind of just doing stuff on his own.
Yeah.
And so just through doing stuff on his own, he's discovered that's like, what the heck do I, like, at the end of the day, I'm going to school, I'm paying all this money just to have this paper, but the paper doesn't mean anything. Mm. If you can learn everything on your own,
yeah,
it just means something to your employer.
Yeah.
But isn't it a lot more valuable to just hire someone and then realize that they could do the job?
Yeah.
How many people must get hired that don't actually know how to do the job?
Yes.
And then have to learn on the fly?
Yeah.
Okay. That's all we're talking about.
Yeah.
It kind of goes back to that argument you guys are always having on the show, whether culinary school is worth it and it's not.
Yeah.
I think it's all schools now, especially trade schools.
That question could be asked of all schools.
Yeah, all
That's
schools.
Interesting.
Because we've discussed, you get bored sometimes, you start discussing things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
what, at work?
At work.
Well, that's one of the great things about working in a restaurant.
Yeah, at the end of the night.
You can do your job while having a
conversation.
Philosophical conversation.
Yeah, that's true. So you've asked.
Or telling stupid jokes. I mean, whatever.
That's okay.
Whichever way you want to go with it, but yes.
So if the question is whether or not culinary school is worth it, right? At the end of the day, on this show. Well, it depends what kind of person you are.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So if you're a type of person that you could just go look everything up and you intuitively can learn, then probably culinary school isn't the best option for you at this point.
Yeah.
Back in the day, we didn't have that.
Yes.
Back in the day, you had to go, forget culinary school, you just had to go to a really good restaurant and hopefully the chef cared that wanted to teach you stuff. But what if the chef didn't like you?
Right.
So now you have to go somewhere else. Yeah. So it's really the same. We're having the same argument, just different ways.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
But I look at that, you just take the scope back a little bit more. I'm like, okay, well, what about other schools?
Yeah.
What other schools are doing this?
Yeah.
Why do you have to do, let's say you want to be a math major or whatever, name your thing, right? There's only so many trades that you really need a lot of school for. Mm-hmm. You definitely need training for a lot of things. Let's say you want to be a great plumber.
Yeah.
Well, why can't you just work with a plumber for a while?
I agree with all. Yeah, I actually probably more agree with what you're saying than don't agree. But I am a big believer in if, you know, you can get it at a state school or wherever. I do believe. I just believe fundamentally in the importance of education.
Right.
You know, I think a lot of the problems we have in this world, I don't need to get too specific right now, a lot of it's due to having a lack of education. I mean, it's why people can't have a lot of, some people can't get better jobs. And I'm not talking about specific, right, or trade thing. I'm just saying, can somebody write an intelligent email, you know? Right. Can somebody communicate well? And then, you know, in life, you know, does someone have an understanding of history and where things go off the tracks, you know,
right,
in the patterns that have emerged over the years? And, you know, and that affects our politics, right? Like,
so does that say more about...
That's sort of how I think about educate. That's where I think of the sort of crucialness of education.
Yeah, I agree
think
with that.
Most things in life, I could have definitely done exactly what I've done with my life, probably with not going to school past high school.
Yeah.
You know, probably. Did I become that much better a writer when I was in college? I don't think probably I did. I think I just got to be a better writer by writing a lot and by growing up and reading.
I definitely agree exactly what you're saying. But it's kind of like, so you take the lens back, you're looking at the scope.
I'll take my friend, for example. He works for Metro, and he runs like maybe 40 different employees, okay. and they're all security guards and stuff.
Okay.
His employer told so he got to the max of like money he was going to make. And but they keep giving him more employees because they keep opening more stations.
Yeah.
But they're not going to give him more money. And right. so he talked to his employee, said, hey, look, I have double the employees that I had when I started.
Yes.
And I haven't gotten a pay raise.
Yeah.
And they said, because you don't have a bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
We can't give you a pay.
Yeah. Right.
So it's like, oh, OK, so they don't actually care if you can do the job. They just want to be able to keep you because you're doing the job. They just don't want to give you more money.
Yeah, but if you're going to, yes, but that's going to be the case in a lot of, you know, there's plenty of people who, I'll give you an example. There are a lot of people who rise up through the ranks in the retail world. Mm-hmm. You know, they work for a company that has, that manufactures something, that has retail stores, or maybe even just a big, like a Home Depot, right? And you come up in retail and you're really good and you're, you know, Johnny on the spot and you problem solve and you're responsible and you manage people well. And maybe you'll get to the corporate office, right? But guess what? You're not going to become a VP if you don't have, like, an MBA.
Right.
You know? Like, you just won't. I mean, a lot of these companies, it's just part of the...
But isn't that just saying more about where our priorities lie?
I agree with you, but I'm just saying eventually that might change. And if it's an independently owned business, it might be different. But for the most part, it's not going to be... Right. You know, there's a guy named Nick Valenti who used to run Restaurant Associates and... And now he's with Joachim Patina Restaurant Group, and Nick was like an intern, and you know, like when he was a kid, they gave him I forget where it was, but he was running like a small restaurant, and like he started offering like complimentary New York Times with Sunday brunch.
Oh, nice!
Right, and like the business went up.
Right,
because
now.
Was hospitality. Yeah. You know, it was like this little thing you got, but they got more customers. Right,
they would like free stuff.
Right, so that was really, but he had the instincts, you know, and then he became eventually all the way up to the chairman of the company, but that's rare.
Right.
That's rare, unless you're the person who
Someone
founded
saw
the company.
Him and said, you know what, this guy's special.
Yeah,
he
and they
it.
Kept moving him up, you know, but anyway, I need to stop.
Sure.
This was great. I'm glad you wrote me. Anyone out there, tell people, Jose, this was pretty good, right?
Yeah, Andrew's a really nice guy, believe it or not. So, yeah, definitely. I want to hear stories from people that I feel like you just get the same people on, you know, even though they have different backgrounds, we're just talking about the same thing. It's like it gets less interesting.
I agree with you. I was at dinner last night and I was telling people, who were actually in the entertainment business, and they were asking me about the show, and they said, you know, do you try to get like the biggest names on? And I said, well, you know, when the show started, I did because I wanted to be noticed quickly,
right?
You know, and I. And if I got offered any big names, I was like, yes, 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 which I would still probably do.
As you should.
But I don't go as much out of my way right now. I'm more looking to talk to, like, you know.
Interesting story.
Well, there's not 20 interviews, no disrespect, but there's not 20 other podcast interviews with you and a Netflix profile.
Especially, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, I don't. You know, there are people out there who are really well known who can still come in and do a live interview and all their answers aren't rehearsed. And that's great. That's great. But it's not the norm necessarily. So I'm more interested in people who, like, no one's heard their story. You know, it's a very individualized story. And like you said when you wrote me, you know, despite all evidence to the contrary, I am actually interested in, you know, there's a guy who has a food truck near my house. And I don't know why he's a little skittish about doing it, but he's got an amazing story. Like, he went to the French Culinary Institute, and he was a cook in London, and now he has this food truck in a little lot up in Westchester, New York.
It's awesome.
It's really great. And, like, I'm dying. He's, like, actually someone I'm working on. Like, I go by for a nice coffee once a week, and I'm like,
Tom Jose said he's got to be on the
Okay. Okay. Anyway, thanks for doing it. Thanks for writing me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Honestly, big fan.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, and I hope we'll stay in touch.
Tell Caitlin I say hello. You're too hard on yourself whenever you're doing.
Yeah.
You're too hard on yourself.
What do you mean?
That you're always saying that no one wants to hear you or this. Don't be so negative.
All right, thank
you. Just be more positive.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. See, you got that. You got that positivity. Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for making a 2.5-hour drive.
No problem.
And that's our show for this week. Thank you to Rose Traore and Jose Arroyo for joining me, for your time, for your honesty, for your openness. I really enjoyed talking to both of you. To Jeet Paul, our engineer, thank you, Jeet, as always, for your help splicing these things together. Special thank you this week to Heritage's executive director, Katie Mosman Wadler. You know why. To everyone at Heritage for all your support. I appreciate it. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening. And we will be back here next week, hopefully with a little bit more chit-chat in the introduction and during the show breaks on Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebrationing happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. And connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.